You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week L.A. Kaufman. L.A. Kaufman is the author of a great new book called Direct Action: Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. She has spent more than 30 years immersed in radical movements as a journalist, historian, organizer, and strategist. Her writings on grassroots activism and social movement history have been in The Nation, The Progressive, Mother Jones, Village Voice, and many others. She served as executive editor for the radical theory journal Socialist Review and as an award-winning national political columnist for SF Weekly, focusing on dissent and activism. Kaufman was the mobilizing coordinator for the massive February 15th, 2003 anti-war protest in New York City. I was there. I imagine many of you were there as well. She continued in this role through the years of major anti-war protests, including those that greeted the 2004 Republican National Convention. L.A. Kaufman, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
It's wonderful to have you on. Tell us a little bit about the origins and the theme of this book, Direct Action, which really goes back to 1971 up through the present.
Yeah, the book has been in the works for a kind of astoundingly long period of time. I actually started it in 1991, believe it or not. So the book has been 25 years in the making, though I, of course, was not working on it every single year throughout that quarter century. But it started when I started feeling some significant shifts in the nature of grassroots organizing and the structure of radical movements. Around the period in the late 80s, early 90s, when ACT UP was at its height, and I started really trying to weave together a single story out of the sprawling array of movements that I was seeing in the radical landscape. And that turned out to be a pretty challenging undertaking. So it was really only after many years of being immersed in movements and really more on history, more history unfolding, that it all came together. And I was able to pull together a single story that encompasses this huge array of grassroots movements that we've seen emerge at the tail end of the 60s, flourish over the intervening decades, and that now are finding expression, of course, in the sprawling opposition to the new presidency.
Yeah, indeed. And it's interesting to me not just to learn bits of history that I didn't know, but that you really pull out particular actions as having been seminal for movements that followed, and they're not necessarily the actions that are most well remembered themselves. Beginning with the May Day 1971 action in Washington, D.C., its size and aggressiveness, racially integrated and inspiring of further actions, and yet not that well known. Can you tell us something about it?
Yeah, May Day 71 is this extraordinary event that almost no one has heard about. There's a lot of events from the 60s that have been, from the 60s anti-war movement, that have been, you know, heavily mythologized, like, you know, the protest at the Democratic Convention in 1968, which actually only involved, you know, a really small number of people, but they have acquired this kind of mythic status. May Day 71 came kind of at the tail end of the movement when people were really growing frustrated that all the years of marching and protesting, resisting the draft, many other forms of organizing had not slowed the war. And in fact, there had been a great escalation in the spring of 1970 with the bombing of Cambodia. So what people decided to do with this protest was to try to shut down the federal government through coordinated but decentralized nonviolent direct action. It wasn't an action where there was a leadership telling people where to go. It was organized that people chose targets and decided to use their bodies and whatever objects that they could, you know, bring out into the street to try to paralyze the nation's capital. And what strikes me about it, it's a fascinating protest, and I use it to open the book as kind of a set piece that introduces a whole bunch of themes about organizing in subsequent decades. But the thing that stands out the most strongly about it, it was an extremely unpopular protest. It was unruly. I mean, it was nonviolent, but it was nonviolent that it was a definition of nonviolence that included, you know, letting the airs out of the tires of cars or dragging, you know, newspaper boxes into the street to create barricades. It was extremely controversial, extremely unpopular, and it worked. There's evidence that it so freaked out the Nixon administration and brought the specter of revolution to their doorstep that it hastened the withdrawal from Vietnam. So when I look through the many years of subsequent protests and when I think about the organizing now, I always keep this framework in mind that a lot of times throughout our history, the movements that have accomplished the most have been the ones that were willing to be unpopular.
And that evidence is in the form of White House discussions that we now have transcripts, or what sort of evidence?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's... you know, historians have mined the rich trove of transcripts from the White House and interviews with subsequent White House aides to say that it was one of the things that really made them think they had to find an exit strategy, that they feared revolution. The idea in a lot of ways it was symbolic. Of course, nobody was going to actually shut down the federal government, even if they managed to stall the traffic in D.C. You know, that's not going to stop the delivery of mail or the dropping of bombs. I mean, it was all, you know, the disruption was always more symbolic than actual. But it was really profoundly scary to the Nixon White House. Profoundly scary while remaining profoundly nonviolent, which I think was really a powerful combination.
Yeah, nonviolent toward living things, violent toward newspaper boxes.
Yeah. Newspaper boxes can take it.
Yeah. So the book is an incredible resource of tactics and knowledge of history, and it goes through the 76 protests in Seabrook, New Hampshire, and the 84 Pledge of Resistance, and the 1987 action at the CIA, and the work of groups like ACT UP, and of course the Seattle WTO, et cetera. But I want to touch on as many of these as we can, but I want to jump ahead to 2003, where you raise the possibility that resistance to the invasion of Iraq might have been more effective had it been more confrontational. Can you describe exactly what you mean and what makes you think that?
Well, I think anyone who was deeply involved in that extraordinary day of protest that took place on, almost exactly 14 years ago on February 15th, 2003, it was the single largest day of protest in world history. It still is. There were protests in, I believe, 792 cities and towns around the world on every continent. And the protests in the United, and many of them were absolutely massive, including the New York one, which was enormous. And yet, despite having brought this incredible number of people into the streets to all say in a single voice no to the Bush's war plans, the war, of course, proceeded unabated. Bush kind of shrugged off the protests, compared them to a focus group. And it was a really dispiriting moment for many people who had been involved in organizing the protests, but also a moment to really reflect on what protests, what big mobilizations like that do and don't accomplish. You know, we tend to have this model in our head, which is already mythologized, of that's kind of based on the 1963 March on Washington, and this oversimplified idea like people came together, they expressed the conscience of the nation in huge numbers, and that in turn led to the passage of civil rights legislation. Mass mobilizations rarely work that well as pressure tactics. They work quite well as movement building tactics, and they work, you know, they do a lot of important political work. But in themselves, they sometimes end up just demonstrating the scale of our powerlessness. That was the way it felt in a lot of mass mobilizations in the 80s. Now, the temper of the times in 2003, there had, you know, after 9/11, there had been, you know, there was already an escalation of police response to protest after the Seattle WTO in response to the real upsurge of the global justice movement. And after 9/11, a real chill descended on the left, and people simply weren't organizing confrontational, disruptive protests, with the exception Direct Action to Stop the War in San Francisco organized a whole bunch of street shutdowns. But, you know, there was a moment when the big coalition that organized the huge protest in New York had to make a choice. We were told we couldn't march, and we had to make a decision. Were we going to march anyway or not? I was on the side who thought that we should have marched anyway, and that we could have had people on the front lines who were willing to risk arrest if that was what it was going to take, in order for people to take the streets and offer a stronger statement than standing in the pens that had been set up by the police to contain us.
Yeah.
It's impossible to say whether if people had really broken out of the constraints on protest to show, a strong nationwide showing of resistance, not just opposition, if it would have changed the course of the ensuing weeks and the conduct of the war. I don't want to second guess what we did, but the feeling of powerlessness was so extraordinary, and it was a feeling that we had pulled out numbers, but we hadn't really used all the tools in our toolbox, and we hadn't really used the tools that send the strongest messages.
Yeah, we're speaking with L.A. Kaufman, whose book is Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. I should note that when people claim that the recent Women's March broke the records, those are national claims, not global. So this single day of action still holds that title for global biggest action that you mentioned. But I think, you know, there are those who make the argument that the war opposition did accomplish something, that it brought nations around the world against the war, the UN to vote against the war, making it illegal rather than having that humanitarian sanction, and that it built opposition that continued for a decade, leading to the situation in 2013 where Congress members were saying, I'm not going to vote to bomb Syria because I'm not going to vote for another Iraq, because Iraq had become this, you know, curse that, you know, stopped Hillary twice and so forth. Is there something to that, or was it not just the marches but other actions that accomplished those changes?
Right. Well, I mean, the movement was, lasted for many years, used many tactics and many approaches, and I think you're absolutely right, David, that it accomplished a lot of things. Another thing that I would point to, when I went to Ferguson after the uprising there and really started interviewing people in depth about how it happened that, you know, so many times when there are the kinds of uprisings that might be characterized as a riot, they kind of happen and burn out. As opposed to doing what happened in Ferguson, where that uprising fed into what we now know as the Movement for Black Lives and the National Black Lives Matter movement. And when I looked at that work, I could look back and see relationships that were built in the anti-war movement across the long-standing divisions of race that have been crippling grassroots movements for decades, and see how those came to fruition in helping strengthen the resistance and the organizing in Ferguson many years later.
Yeah.
So, you know, these movements sometimes the effects are, you know, outside of the issue focus of a particular movement. Sometimes they're many years later. It can be, the fact that we didn't stop the war doesn't mean that it wasn't worth doing all the work that took place. The anti-war movement absolutely, built and strengthened cross-racial networks of resistance that it were then called on in many other contexts later.
Yeah, indeed. And the book is excellent on the behind-the-scenes work in Ferguson of organizers to bring in supplies and resources and activists from outside Ferguson to strengthen what was happening more or less spontaneously. But I think some of us were on organizing calls with UFPJ for several years, pushing unsuccessfully for more aggressive strategies outside of permits and so forth. And there was one year when, you know, there was always actions on the anniversary of the attack on Baghdad. And there was one year in D.C. where the plan was sort of a mixture. We will have permitted rallies in parks and blocking of streets and dancing in the streets and, you know, blocking of doors of weapons profiteers' buildings and so forth. And it turned out, I thought, to be a rather useful combination in that when people saw that there had apparently been an order not to arrest anybody, and so people were dragged out of the streets and then danced right back into them, and it became a joke, people who ordinarily wouldn't have engaged in nonviolent resistance, you know, left the safe rallies in the parks and went into the streets. And then we never tried that again in the subsequent years. What do you recall that at all? And is there any sort of other examples of that model of combining two approaches?
I missed that particular one. That was after I had left UFPJ. And so I missed that particular one. People still talk about that as having been a really powerful day of action. I mean, I think that model has been used in a lot of different contexts of having, you know, it was even used on Inauguration Day of having some spaces where there are permitted rallies or permitted marches so that everyone can feel comfortable going there no matter if they're bringing their kids or what their immigration status is or if they've got an open warrant for jumping a turnstile or, you know, or whatever thing you might have in your life that makes you really not able to risk any kind of engagement with the police. You know, that those kind of spaces as a safe container while people do more interesting, more disruptive kinds of actions in other places and time. So that, you know, playing with that combination of how to have a day that is multi-tactical, but where there's, you know, different levels of risk are geographically separated, that's something people have been playing with. I mean, a lot, you know, going back in Seattle there, that was one of the models that was used at the Seattle WTO protest. And I think now as we have so many people interested in taking action who are doing so for the first time, or maybe now they're up to the second or third time since people have been to a lot of protests in recent weeks, those kind of models are going to be really powerful because they make a place for stronger forms of resistance without privileging it so much that other people can't be part of the day.
Yeah. I am struck, you know, I was at the time of 9/11 working for a group called ACORN that used direct action, you know, every day of the year for the whole period that this book covers. And that on that day, it was just universally understood that now nobody can do anything. And I couldn't understand it. It seemed ridiculous to me. Why in the heck not? You know, I mean, we were gonna accomplish all sorts of great legislation in Washington, you know, in the coming weeks, and nope, everything's off. And I wonder if there's anything we can do as activists or educators to change that, you know, next time, God forbid, there's something resembling 9/11 in some way. Do all good movements have to be shut down, or can we sort of prepare ourselves not to do that?
You mean shut down in response, you know, after the 9/11 attacks?
Right. After the 9/11 attacks, all good progressive causes and activist movements sort of said nothing good is permissible now. We must all go crawl under our beds and wait, and there will be a day when it's more appropriate to challenge our government. But for the moment, we must bow down before its most tyrannical impulses and let everything roll over us.
Yeah, I mean, that's not how I remember the period right after 9/11. I was in New York. I'm not sure where you were. I mean, I remember, you know, I remember thousands of people in Union Square. I remember all the messages that people wrote in chalk on the square and all the signs that people had. And I remember it wasn't so much that movements went home. It was that between the very real grief that everyone was feeling for the slaughter that had taken place in our city, thousands of people had been just murdered in our city. There was a sense that the kind of protest that had preceded that moment no longer worked. A lot of what the spirit of the global justice movement had been was this idea of a carnival against capital, festive resistance in the street. And there was a real shifting of gears. You know, people who had been, you know, trying to, you know, synthesize party and protest and music and culture in the streets in that kind of heavy atmosphere after 9/11, it was very, very difficult to mobilize. And it wasn't so much that the organizations folded up as that the it was kind of at the level of the foot soldiers. It was the level, you know,
right.
The fear and the grief allowed people to be more passive than they might have been otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. I'm wondering, you know, if we can sort of learn to experience the grief that the U.S. military causes all the time in distant places and not be shut down by grief when, you know, a bit of it happens to hit the United States, but in fact escalate our resistance to the destruction.
Right. I mean, sometimes with organizing, you know, there's something just ineffable about, you know, the moments when people feel moved to act and when they don't. There's something, you know, after having been doing this for many years, you know, there are these moments. Mark and Paul Engler, who wrote the wonderful recent book called This Is an Uprising, called them, you know, the movements of the moments of the whirlwind, when when people, you know, are suddenly in huge numbers moved to step outside their comfort zone, do more than they normally would. You know, the period after the election in November and the inauguration felt a little bit to me like that post 9/11 feeling. I went to a lot of protests, and they were all small, and they were all depressing.
Yes.
And there was something about the Women's March. I didn't predict this in advance, but there was something about the Women's March that it just like changed the alchemy. It was this moment of, you know, a kind of shedding of the fear and the grief and the paralysis after the election and kind of bursting out into action that was so heartening and so powerful. You know, there's something about these things that you can't quite, you organize and you do what you can to make things happen as an organizer, but there's certain things that you can't plan for that, you know, again, I'm kind of reach for these metaphors like alchemy or something that
right.
It just happens, a kind of magic, a collective magic. Fortunately, we're in one of those periods where people are, thank goodness, you know, stepping up and doing more and taking risks because it's obviously desperately and urgently needed.
Yeah, I wonder, are you familiar with a book called Party in the Streets that looks at the partisan nature of the anti-war movement in the past decade?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
This
book
is a study done by a couple of professors who went to all the anti-war actions over the past decade or so and asked people all sorts of questions in surveys. And they came up with the idea that the biggest mobilizer in, you know, 03, 04 was identification between anti-war and Democratic Party. And you brought in lots of members of the Democratic Party, which was also the biggest reason why around 07, 08, 09, mobilizations got much smaller and the funding dried up and so forth. And So as someone who would love to see an anti-war movement that wasn't, you know, anti-Republican wars, but just anti-wars and able to sustain itself as faces change in the White House, I was more encouraged by protests at airports that were spontaneous than by, you know, the Women's March that, you know, will never say a word against war and had Debbie Wasserman Schultz up there on the stage in D.C. and so forth because of the partisan handicap. What are your thoughts on that?
See, when I look at the Women's March, what strikes me about it is that it was mostly self-mobilized. I mean, they didn't have an infrastructure or a pre-existing organizational infrastructure that then brought the march into place. They assembled the organizational infrastructure in the course of mobilizing, and most of what people did was to self-mobilize to get there. When you were there in D.C., I mean, it was this combination of the kind of chills down your spine of realizing, you know, after having been at February 15th, 2003, and many other huge protests, that this was bigger than any of them.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I don't think I've ever seen such a high percentage of handmade signs in a crowd, right? This is people who, like, made their own signs, organized their own groups. There weren't, like, big... Yes, there were some buses that came and so forth, but there weren't the kind of bus operations and marshals and all this kind of infrastructure that I mean, nuts and bolts infrastructure that you know, people who've done these kind of mobilizations in the past are used to seeing. So I actually think that there's a lot of continuity and similarity between just a difference in scale between the Women's March and the airport protests, which were also, you know, obviously they weren't completely self-organized. There were longstanding immigrant rights groups who put out the call to action very early on, who'd been tracking the issue, who secured the space at JFK, you know, who helped reach out to the legal teams. But it was that similar sense of people self-mobilizing in response to a crisis. And, you know, there it wasn't even handmade signs because nobody had time to make a sign. There was a package of markers and people were salvaging cardboard from the garbage cans. And that, you know, that's what the signage was at the beginning of the protest there. I tend to not look at, like, who's on the stage as where the meaning of a protest lies. I'm much more interested in what networks got mobilized, what groups got engaged, you know, what organizing happened behind the scene rather than who's up there speaking and supposedly representing the event. I don't see the same contrast between the two that you do.
Yeah, well, I certainly see much that's encouraging, and would much rather see people turn out for any sort of action, even if I'd like to tweak it a little bit. There are incredible resources and guides to making things better as we go forward in this history. Direct Action is the title, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism by L.A. Kaufman. We'll have info and links up at talknationradio.org. L.A. Kaufman, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It's been a pleasure.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersnap.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, early morning deportation raids are stoking fears in immigrant communities, pulling parents from children and shipping people who've lived in the U.S. for decades to places they don't remember. Donald Trump talks about rounding up quote-unquote drug lords and murderers, but not only is that not who is being targeted, recently released executive orders expand the category of criminal alien to any immigrant who has been accused of a crime or who someone thinks may have committed one. The evidence of the chaos and harm deportation policies inflict is in the spotlight right now. Can we use the moment to talk about resisting viewing immigration policy through a lens of criminality? Jettisoning the pretense that these measures, from Obama's stated felons not families approach to this new conceit about bad hombres, are really about public safety? That shift will be key in moving toward a humane vision of immigration. We'll talk about that with Mazui Izeki, Deputy Director of the Immigrant Defense Project. That's coming up, but first we will take a look back at recent press. Are liberals helping Trump? Asks the New York Times national correspondent Sabrina Tavernise in a February 18th piece. She seems to think they are. Readers are introduced to Jeffrey Medford, a small business owner in South Carolina who voted reluctantly for Donald Trump and should be a natural ally for liberals trying to convince the country that Mr. Trump was a bad choice because some things are making him feel uncomfortable. But, quote, every time Mr. Medford dips into the political debate, either with strangers on Facebook or friends in New York and Los Angeles, he comes away feeling battered by contempt and an attitude of moral superiority, close quote. Medford is emblematic, we're told, of conservative voters turned off by, quote, a kind of moral Bolshevism, the belief that the liberal vision for the country was the only right one, close quote. Liberals, quote, may feel energized by a surge in political activism and a unified stance against a president they see as irresponsible and even dangerous. But that momentum is provoking an equal and opposite reaction on the right, close quote. Well, Tavernise references one Trump supporter who has deleted all her news feeds on Facebook and tries to watch less TV. Withdrawing from current events might be an opposite reaction from your typical Trump opponent, but it's not equal. The argument seems to be, quote, if political action is meant to persuade people that Mr. Trump is bad for the country, then people on the fence would seem a logical place to start. Yet many seemingly persuadable conservatives say that liberals are burning bridges rather than building them, close quote. Well into the piece, we get some polling data that tries to back this up. We learn that Trump has high marks among moderates who lean Republican. 70% approve, while 20% disapprove. But the piece doesn't take any broader look at polling, which is wise, because that would take the air completely out of the argument. A quick look at Gallup shows that Donald Trump started out as the least popular new president in the history of polling. And since then, he's become more unpopular still, with disapproval rising 10 percentage points and approval falling 5 points. That's approximately 25 million U.S. adults who have started disapproving of Trump's month-old presidency, and about 12 million who have stopped supporting it. Now, it's possible that without Trump's critics' moral Bolshevism, even more people would have joined the opposition. But if liberals are helping Trump, they're not helping him very much. If you are concerned that someone has authoritarian tendencies, it's a very bad idea to treat them as though they have the power to rewrite the law. But many outlets did that in reporting on Trump's withdrawal of the Obama administration's guidance to schools on the rights of transgender students. Headlines like, "Trump administration rolls back protections for transgender students," or "rescinds protections for transgender students," or "withdraws federal protections on transgender bathrooms in schools." All of those headlines, notes the new civil rights movement, are inaccurate. Trump does not have the power to unilaterally change what rights transgender students have. These rights derive from Title IX, a federal law passed in 1972 that bars discrimination based on gender in publicly funded schools. It was a series of federal court rulings, not the Obama administration's say-so, that found that that protection extends to transgender students. The Obama guidance to school administrators was about, among other things, how they had to allow trans students to use restrooms that correspond with their gender identity. Its withdrawal, New Civil Rights Movement's David Badash says, is a wink and a nod, a telegraphing that the Justice Department under Trump will not vigorously enforce Title IX, at least when it comes to transgender children. As Lambda Legal said in a statement, Trump's actions do not change the law itself. Transgender students remain protected by Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. But abandoning the guidance intentionally creates confusion about what federal law requires. Well, journalists should not contribute to that confusion. In an era where the White House is bent on taking away rights from vulnerable groups, it's important to be clear on the rights we have. Since 2010, The Washington Post has been banking on its pedigree and prestige by putting on Q&A sessions called Post Live with influential Beltway personalities, quarterbacked by a Post columnist or reporter, and, yes, sponsored by corporations directly involved in the topics of discussion. Event sponsors have included Bank of America, Eli Lilly, GlaxoSmithKline, and United Health, among others. The ideological scope of these events, writes Adam Johnson on Fair.org, ranges from how capitalism and the U.S. military can be more awesome to capitalism and the U.S. military are already awesome. Four events in 2016 titled Securing Tomorrow were sponsored by weapons manufacturer Raytheon and the Center for a New American Security, a D.C. think tank largely funded by weapons contractors, the Defense Department, the Japanese government, and U.S. oil companies. Included, the Post's David Ignatius talking about the military in the first-person plural. Not included, any talk about reducing war or spending on war. Post spokesperson Chris Corradi told Fair the paper draws a hard line between the content of our events, which are developed and run by our newsroom, and our sponsors. Sponsors do not pay our people, nor do they have any say in the programming. Well, except that a representative of Raytheon is actually in the programming, giving remarks. Opening remarks are their own, Corradi contended, and not part of the news program. Well, it's unclear what that means or how it would be discerned from the event agenda, which sandwiched the sponsor remarks of Raytheon Vice President Rick Hunt between the welcome remarks of the Washington Post's Vice President of Communications, that's Chris Corradi, and the conversation with Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, all listed in the same typeface. It seems hardly plausible that the Washington Post sees no conflict in hosting a news event called Is Technology Improving Your Health? That's sponsored by Philips, which describes itself as a leading health technology company focused on improving people's health. You'd have to conclude instead that they are fundamentally untroubled by gatherings that, by design, exclude any voices that would meaningfully question corporate sponsors or the state representatives who take part, and that trade on their journalistic credibility to serve as a revenue stream for their parent company. And finally, a petition spearheaded by the group Just Foreign Policy calls on the New York Times to report on warnings from the UN and international aid groups that Yemen is on the edge of full-blown famine. There is already much to be said about U.S. complicity in the humanitarian crisis in Yemen through its military and diplomatic support for Saudi Arabia's war in the country. But Huffington Post reporters Jessica Schulberg and Ryan Grimm reported recently on concerns that the Trump White House may be looking away from preparations by the Saudi-led coalition to attack a port called Hodeidah, which serves as the entry point to supply some 80% of Yemen's humanitarian needs. The Obama administration had apparently discouraged such attacks. Now, relief workers say the coalition is redirecting ships carrying food away from Hodeidah, a redirection that itself is harmful to relief efforts, but may also signal an attack. UN humanitarian coordinator Jamie McColdrick says, speaking of the coalition, quote, clearly they have some plans militarily for the port. It's part and parcel of an attempt to try and weaponize the economy, close quote. He notes that even a short-term halt of the flow of goods through Hodeidah would cut off life-saving food aid to Yemenis already on the brink of starvation. Senator Chris Murphy told the Huffington Post, "We are currently being blamed for the human misery inside Yemen, and conditions there are radicalizing Yemenis against the United States. Our policy should be to try to abate the human misery, not take steps that would increase it," which Murphy notes is bad from a moral perspective and a national security perspective. It certainly sounds like enough to warrant a story in the country's paper of record. Just Foreign Policy's Robert Naiman was struck by the fact that as of February 22nd, the New York Times had only run wire stories on the situation with no original reporting. You can go to justforeignpolicy.org to sign a petition to the Times calling on them to give the story the attention it merits. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Vicious, extreme, and frightening, some of the terms being used to describe the Trump administration's announced plans on immigration. The executive orders and attendant guidance memos greatly expand the category of people prioritized for deportation. The category of criminal could now include someone accused of a crime or believed to be a risk, along with essentially deputizing local and state law enforcement to act as immigration officials and cutting federal resources to cities that don't go along with the program. Stories of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, pulling people out of hospitals and parents away from children are providing vivid illustration of what may be ahead, even as they show us that it was, in some senses, already here. In resistance to these actions, what the New York Times called the brutal idiocy of it all, perhaps we have an opportunity for a deeper rethinking of deportation policy in general, grounded in the idea that, as our next guest wrote recently in a column for Huffington Post, human beings who happen to be non-citizens have fundamental rights, too. Mazui Izeki is deputy director of the Immigrant Defense Project. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Mazui Izeki.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Many people saw the gut-wrenching pictures when Guadalupe Garcia de Grajos was taken away in a van. She was a 35-year-old mother of two in Phoenix who checked in with immigration officials regularly because she was out of status, and this time they took her and sent her to Mexico, where she hasn't lived since she was 14. A New York Times editorial reflected a pervasive kind of response. The headline was, "Bad dude? No, but deported anyway." Trump promised to go after criminal aliens, the paper said, but Ms. Rios fits no such definition and was no threat. Now, it's clear that the paper opposes the policy generally, but we're still inside this frame of criminality as criterion. I wonder, what do you see as the problems with this criminal immigrant approach with regard to deportation?
You know, just to put it a little bit into context, you know, I think the broader problem is, you know, especially over the past 20 years, that we have experienced the rapid development of the world's largest system to imprison and exile immigrants. And the heart of the system has been this government-constructed state of emergency that really relies on racialized fear and has constricted the entire criminal legal system from the police to the courts to the prisons to probation and eternally brands people as so-called criminals. And, You know, I think this it's definitely a challenge in terms of who is deserving and who is undeserving of rights. But, you know, in many ways, that's the heart of criminalization, right, where a system of criminalization basically expands and legitimizes surveillance and regulation and punishment of these certain peoples and communities, while at the same time determining that they don't deserve any protection.
I remember an article long ago in the New York Times called Criminal Communities, which really highlighted for me the way they're often, it's not, we read it as a singling out of criminality, but in fact, it's almost always being used to brand or to target entire communities of people.
Yeah, and I think in terms of the particular context of immigration, you know, the exclusion and expulsion of particular groups of people who have been deemed a threat or un-American has very much been part of the whole project of nation building since the very beginning, right? Where, you know, certain bodies represent an imminent or inherent threat, from the Native Americans to people formerly enslaved people, you know, and like fast forward to the current day, right, where the target is, you know, people from Muslim countries or criminalized immigrants. And, you know, I think where we really saw convergence of this is in the 1990s, right, where you know, very highly punitive frame was applied to so many aspects of U.S. policy, whether in welfare or the crime bill. And in the case of immigrants, these particularly harsh immigration policies, which rapidly expanded the number of criminal offenses that would subject someone to deportation, but also made deportation a mandatory minimum in the vast majority of cases. It's at this particular moment that we're living in, the convergence of the war on the poor and then on immigrants and overall on criminalized people of color, converge with these themes of, you know, personal responsibility, law and order, and the rule of law that we've been fighting against since the 1990s.
It really does seem that we can't get at these problems if we don't see them as connected in that way, if we don't see that coherence. I mean, when we look at deportation policy, you have to look at something like broken windows policing here in New York, in which people, black and brown people, are targeted for arrest on things like quality of life, selling loose cigarettes, and then they have the quote-unquote criminal record that can now make them subject to deportation. It seems like you really can't make sense in terms of pushback, in terms of resistance, unless you see these things as of a piece.
Yeah, I mean, I think the frame and the logic behind zero tolerance or broken windows policing is exactly what we're experiencing right now under, especially under the Trump administration and the memos that you mentioned in the beginning, where people, you know, the frame of criminalization is expanded to anyone who's ever committed something that you could be arrested for, which is basically anybody, I would argue. And then, you know, or if you have been arrested, but your charges are still pending. And then, of course, people with a wide range of criminal convictions. But, you know, today in the New York Post, there was a NYPD detective from Queens who basically made this very parallel. He equates ICE activities to broken windows policing, where he says, you know, it's a privilege to live in this country, not a right. And is it asking too much to ask someone to not commit a crime? So the very existence of this person being here is, you know, a threat.
Well, wow. Well, in terms of reporting, the imperviousness to fact is troubling. I mean, I have seen the statistics showing that the crime rate has in fact declined during the period in which the immigration population increased, including in gateway cities like Miami and El Paso. So when Donald Trump stands up to sign these orders with family members, people who've had family members killed by immigrants, as a representation of the issue being addressed, the clash between image and reality, I think, can be overwhelming, including for reporters who are supposed to be sorting it out for us.
Yeah, and I think this is where the kind of age-old role of racialized fear really comes in, where there are certain ideas of othering and who doesn't belong and who presents a threat that are very much part of the whole idea of who belongs, right, or who has rights. And it's definitely a challenge because you're absolutely right. The reality doesn't match at all anywhere the threat or the risk. And this is consistent with policies about mass policing and mass imprisonment, whether you're citizen or non-citizen, right? The crime rate has been decreasing since the 70s, and yet the society becomes more and more punitive. And so, you know, I think partly how we're trying to elevate a conversation, at least amongst those who would listen, is, you know, in this era of, you know, the era of economic restructuring that has been happening since the 60s through the 70s and 90s, like what the government's response has been is to embody the blame for economic and social problems or disorder on people, right, as opposed to the system. And part of the challenge that we face is the massive diversion of resources to surveillance, to imprisonment and deportation, and expanding of police forces, right? And so, you know, I think at this moment, despite all the challenges we face, it's really a moment for those of us working against racialized policing, expansion of the police state, and mass imprisonment and mass deportation to collectively join forces and figure out the spaces where we can fight. And that's already happening. It's been happening for a while. But I think in terms of concretely pushing back on this moment, it's, you know, a moment to kind of rethink the past 20, 30 years, how we got here, and how ideologies like broken windows have really become normalized and need to be challenged.
I just saw a report from a group that's called CIVIC, Community Initiatives for Visiting Immigrants in Confinement, and it said that media coverage, while it's often critical of deportation policy, in this case specifically the detention system itself, we tend to hear very little from immigrants themselves or from people in those systems themselves. Now, vulnerable and out-of-status people are not the easiest for reporters to talk to, obviously, for various reasons, including access. But overall, I wonder, how do you think the inclusion of those voices might change coverage and perhaps public understanding? And is there anything that you would like to see media in particular doing at this point on this set of issues?
I think in this current moment, you know, one of the challenges that we face is because we receive news in so many different ways and information like through social media is kind of a return back to more what I would call like long form or investigative reporting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I found one of the most compelling articles about this impact of broken windows policing is an article that was in The New Yorker on Kalief Brower and what happened to him, a young man from the Bronx who was arrested for stealing a backpack and then was held in Rikers for years in solitary confinement for a large part of it and then end up committing suicide after he was released. And so I think that, you know, one of the issues that happens is when we use words like deportation or detention, they're almost sanitized, right? What does that mean to people to be incarcerated, to be locked up, to be taken away from your family? You know, I was talking to my colleague this morning about trying to stop the deportation of a man who is, the government is trying to deport back to Honduras. He, in the last 50 years, he's only spent 12 days there. That's not his home. And he has three children who are adults but are severely disabled and rely daily, minute to minute, on his care. And so there's a deep cruelty to this system that would definitely be elevated by including the voices of people who've been directly impacted. And I think that that's a good place to start. That's where we need to start.
Well, and that actually just makes me think of another point, which is that a number of the stories that we're reading raise questions about whether or not these orders will pass legal muster, whether they're really enforceable or workable. And that is absolutely important. But we should recognize, shouldn't we, that announcements like this can have an effect even without going through the whole process of becoming official laws. I mean, they do kind of green light behavior, don't they?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And I feel like within the immigrant communities right now, there's widespread fear. There's trauma that impacts on children who have to live with either the fear of themselves or their parents being taken away from them. We all are hearing, you know, more stories about racial profiling of police and targeting of people who they perceive to be immigrants. And I think that, you know, this is one of the challenges that we face in this particular political moment is a kind of a callousness and a acceptance of intolerance or a codification, I guess, of intolerance that we're going to have to figure out how to push back on.
Well, and I guess you have addressed that. I did want to ask, you know, what are some elements of what a humane immigration policy would look like? And what are we, a lot of what we're talking about in these days is we feel like we're in chaos almost, but we don't want to settle back to the status quo ante. You know, we want to have a new vision that we're pushing for. And you've talked about making connections between groups and different sorts of work. That's, I guess, a part of the vision of the humane immigration policy that we could be fighting for.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it sounds so simple to seem almost silly, but I think that the basis of a humane immigration policy really is to begin to respect people fully as human beings. We're living again in a moment where people have been reduced to negative labels and determined as being therefore undeserving of the most basic human rights. And, you know, this is phenomenon of exclusion, expulsion, and extreme punishment is not limited just to the United States and the boundaries of this country, but really it's a global phenomenon. And if we step back and think about, you know, what is the function of controlling borders in this way, and what is the function of excluding certain people or punishing people and exiling them, and it's to reinforce a system of inequality where certain people have access to mobility and to wealth, and, you know, the vast majority of the world's population are denied that. And so I think, you know, if we're starting to look back kind of humanely, it has to be a global approach, which also takes into consideration the historical and economic and political forces that push people to migrate.
We've been speaking with Mazui Izeki of Immigrant Defense Project. They're online at imdefense, that's immdefense.org. Mazui Izeki, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find those on FAIR's website. It's FAIR.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network or to subscribe to our newsletter, Extra. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
They call it the Great Acceleration. In 1950, human activity departed from the old cycle of ice and warmer times into a new geological age. We do not know what it will be like or how far it will go towards an ice-free world. But now we have the formula in new science presented in this program. Then we go to Australia, where burning heat, searing heat, has created the ultimate fire conditions. That will happen more and more, not only in Australia, but in North America, the Mediterranean, and Russia. We'll talk extreme fires. I'm Alex Smith. Get ready with Radio Eco Shock.
This is Radio Eco Shock.
Continuing human interference in the natural systems of planet Earth could lead to, quote, abrupt changes in the Earth system that could trigger societal collapse. Now, that's not from a conspiracy blog, but in a scientific journal article published February 10th. And there's a lot more in that big picture from authors Owen Gaffney and Will Steffen. Owen Gaffney has a technical background as an astronautic engineer. He's a hybrid between an author of scientific papers and a communicator of big science issues. Gaffney aids the Future Earth Project. He's also the director of international media and strategy at the Stockholm Resilience Center. From Stockholm, Owen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's nice to be here.
In 2014, we had German journalist Christian Schwagerl announce the Anthropocene with his new book. What is the Anthropocene, and when did scientists realize we had entered a new geologic age?
Okay, so I guess the Anthropocene is the age of humans, and I guess that, in a nutshell, is a good starting point for a discussion. And what do we mean by the age of humans? Well, you know, technically geologists split Earth into various time periods. You know, the Jurassic is possibly the most famous, and the Triassic, Permian, and the last 11,700 years, Earth came out of an ice age and into a new geological epoch, the Holocene, which has been a remarkably stable period in Earth's history. And almost as soon as we came out of that stable period, agriculture emerged because hunter-gatherers could predict the temperature year on year, and planting crops suddenly made more sense. And from that, we had villages and towns and civilization flourishing. So we've been in this Holocene for 11,000 years, and now humans are changing the Earth system to such a degree that scientists say, well, actually, we're no longer in the Holocene. We're in a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene.
The deniers always say, Owen, that Earth has seen many climate changes. Prior to human intervention, briefly, what were the major causes of those heating and cooling periods?
Yeah, so I should say first that the geological epochs and geological changes are not always directly related to climate. Other events can cause a shift in a geological epoch. You know, a new evolutionary direction for species suddenly appears in the sedimentary record in the rocks, and this might signify a new geological epoch in some shape or form. But many of them, due to climate change. And so what causes the climate to change? Well, we have astronomical forces. We have the changes in Earth's tilt and its axis and its orbit around the sun, changes in the sun's heat output. We have other gravitational effects from Saturn and Jupiter, and also all blending to cause these astronomical changes. You know, a huge meteorite impact or asteroid impacts can knock Earth out of joint. Volcanic eruptions. So several of the cooler episodes in the Holocene over the last few thousand years, they've been caused by a spate of volcanic eruptions, putting huge amounts of sulfates, small particles, into the upper atmosphere, blocking the heat from the sun and cooling the planet marginally for a period. So these are the kind of natural forcings. Then you have tectonic forcings too. As continents collide, they can cut off oceans or cut an ocean in two, and then the ocean currents move in different directions, and then you get heat redistributed around the planet in a different way, or continents rip apart and open up new channels, and again, heat can be redistributed in different ways. And then, you know, the Earth system then is dynamic and shift around to this new order, and you can get a shift in the climate and other things. You know, you get evolutionary shifts, you know, shifts to other parts of the cycle, the nitrogen cycle, the water cycle, the sedimentary cycle, etc.
Well, you mentioned that we've been lucky enough to have about 11,000 years of relative stability to the point where we can say, well, this is sea level. We're not used to sea levels going way up and way down as they have in the past. But you do say in the paper, quote, Homo sapiens evolved during a rather unusual state of potential instability in Earth's history. So was the climate already potentially unstable?
Yeah. So we've been lulled into a false sense of security. So the Holocene has been remarkably stable, and a lot of Earth system scientists talk about this remarkable stability, which is true. But if we zoom out a little bit, you know, the Holocene is part of the Quaternary period and another level up. And the Quaternary, we've been in for about 2.5 million years. And during this period, we've gone into deep ice ages and then come out of them into these relatively warm periods called interglacials, and then back into deep ice ages, like a tick-tock cycle every 40,000 years for a while, and then every 100,000 years, and all largely related to Earth's orbit around the sun, pushing us slight shifts in it every Earth's tilts and on its axis, and very, very slight shifts, which are measurable, can push Earth in and out of these ice ages. And this is actually a little bit unusual in that for millions and millions of years, Earth can go into deep ice ages with nothing, or very, very warm periods where there's very little ice, if any ice on the planet, very stable for millions of years. And suddenly, for 2.5 million years, we're in this period of just tick-tocking, just a slight forcings can shift us. And in the midst of this tick-tock cycle, suddenly emerges humans, Homo sapiens, on the plains of the Rift Valley in eastern Africa. And now, 200,000 years later, they're affecting the Earth system so profoundly that we're moving beyond the Earth system envelope of the Holocene, and in fact, moving beyond the envelope of these interglacial cycles into uncharted waters.
What is the Great Acceleration?
So back in 2004, a group of scientists working at the International Geosphere-Biosphere Program published a synthesis, and it's this huge green book, academic text on the state of the Earth system. And, the International Geosphere-Biosphere Program at that stage had been running for about, since 87, so, about 17, 18 years. They published this synthesis, and the program really brought together a lot of researchers working on oceanography and cryospheric research, the ice sheets, the atmospheric research, land use, and looking at the changes in the Holocene, and particularly this late Holocene and what people had begun to call the Anthropocene. And they put together a series of graphs in there, 24 graphs, and 12 of the graphs were looking at socioeconomic change since 1800, since the start of the Industrial Revolution, and looking at population growth, GDP, foreign direct investment, dams, farming, changes to the nitrogen cycle through using fertilizers, and tourism, globalization, as marked out by the number of McDonald's that it sprouted up. And then from these 12 graphs, there's another 12 graphs, sort of counterpart to them, looking at Earth system change, greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, methane, and changes to the water cycle, changes to biodiversity, changes to land use, deforestation, and changes to the oceans and biogeochemical cycles. And what's remarkable about these, all running from 1800, is that around 1950, they were growing steadily from 1800 onwards, and definitely significant growth compared with pre-industrial. But it really was in 1950 that marks the beginning of something really remarkable, where all of these graphs, all 24, just suddenly start bending upwards and accelerating, and until this day, you know, continuing to accelerate. And it's quite obvious that this socioeconomic system is driving huge change in the Earth system. So this was known colloquially as the Great Acceleration. I think it was coined the Great Acceleration at the meeting in Germany in 2006. And then in 2015, Will Steffen and co-author of mine and colleagues Cornelia Ludwig and Lisa Deutsch and Wendy Broadgate, we published an updated version of the Great Acceleration graphs. We wanted to see what had happened 10 years on from the first publication and see if there had been any changes in the trajectory, to re-examine the data, see if there's any better data out there. And so we published, and again, I mean, what we saw was that the pattern is largely continuing very much so. We're still in the midst of this great acceleration. What we also tried to do was to look at some of the drivers as well, like you know, is it population growth per se or is it something different? And we were able to establish that, you know, population growth is obviously an important factor, but that by and large, the biggest factor is consumption and production of 1 billion people living in developed world in industrialized societies, as opposed to the 6 billion or so living in less developed societies.
We are going to talk about your large-scale formula for our current situation. But first, Owen, I can't get past figure 2 in your paper. On one side is a kind of universe of climate change with ups and downs of temperature, like the ice ages and hotter periods we talked about. But then we seem to have left that orbit for spaces unknown. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So in figure 2 in the paper, we show these basins of attraction. In complex systems, we draw these basins of attraction where you're pulled like a sort of gravitational force into a recurring cycle, and then slight changes can put you out of that cycle and into another cycle. So in the figure, and so it's almost like a sort of an Earth's orbit around the sun, but what we're talking about here is Earth's orbit around its into different stable states. And so we have the big glacial state. And then every 100,000 years, we will push into another orbit. You know, the gravitational forces will pull us into a different state, these interglacials. So we try to depict this as these cycles every 100,000 years. And we have a huge amount of evidence growing from the Earth system community that what's happening right now, since the start of the Great Acceleration, you know, caused by this huge socioeconomic growth, is that we're pushing Earth out of the basin of attraction of the Holocene, out of the basin of attraction of the interglacials, into something else. And we mark on it, well, we could be pulling ourselves into some sort of Anthropocene stable state, if such a state exists. We don't know if there's what kind of stable states are out there and what kind of pull will, what kind of attraction will take us into these stable states. And then I suppose far off on the horizon is this risk of going into the greenhouse attractor, which we know is a stable state of the Earth system. We know Earth has remained in that state for millions of years. So there's always that risk that what are the drivers or the pulls that would pull you into that. And these are still, you know, unknown questions that remain to be answered, which is why humanity is taking quite a big risk pulling ourselves beyond this interglacial boundary.
Well, one little problem along the way to that stable greenhouse state is the possibility of a sixth great extinction, which many scientists have warned is already in progress. I did interview Anthony Barnosky from the University of California about that back in 2009, and I noticed his 2012 paper is referenced in your paper. How big a risk is that, in your opinion?
Yeah, so again, as part of the Earth system change, we are the start of the, you know, a sixth mass extinction. I mean, and this is, to me, is quite incredible. You know, the last time we had a mass extinction on this scale was 66 million years ago, when an asteroid hit Earth and wiped out the non-avian dinosaurs. So, you know, this is the kind of scale humans are operating on. So this is largely down to land use, you know, land clearing. And we are causing extinction rates at rates, you know, 10 to 100 times faster than the background rate. And, of course, we, you know, at the Stockholm Resilience Center, we talk about resilience a lot, the resilience of a system, and, you know, how a system can take knocks and then return to its normal state, like a spring. You pull a spring and it'll spring back to normal. But, you know, as you keep stretching the spring, it's not going to come back to normal as much, and it's not going to bounce back in the same way. And as you change a system, you can reduce its resilience. So this is part of the risk we're taking, is that, you know, the biodiversity, we know biodiversity enhances resilience. We know that if you have many, many species, then an ecosystem forest with many, many species can take knocks. It can bounce back easier than a system with very few species in it. So we're looking at the stability of the Earth system as a global interconnected system. And the concern is, though, that as we reduce biodiversity, then we reduce the resilience of that system, and we're already pushing the system in myriad ways, you know, greenhouse gas emissions, ocean acidification, the changes to the nitrogen cycle and eutrophication. So what we have been able to say and establish about the Earth system in normal circumstances may not apply in these new situations.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Owen Gaffney from the Stockholm Resilience Center. We're talking about leaving Earth's past behind, entering a new age created by human beings. Oh, and let's get to the new formula presented in this paper, the Anthropocene Equation. To be frank, it's a tough one for listeners to grasp, I think, and maybe even harder on radio. Why don't we start with this idea? Why is a mega formula needed?
So I guess when we published the paper in 2015 on the Great Accelerations, we were doing a lot of talks, lectures to the scientific community and public talks, and writing about it in the media and the scientific press. And we would use similar phrases to kind of sum up what this great acceleration is, what these thousands, tens of thousands of data points mean, which is this Earth system where everything's connected to everything else. Now humans are intrinsically connected into it and affecting it. And we're trying to sum this up in a kind of soundbite or just a sentence. And we'd say things like, humans now rival the great forces of nature, or humans are the prime driver of change on Earth, or we're the size of an asteroid impact, or we're like an ice age. And it occurred to me that they are all very true. They sound rhetorical, these kinds of statements, and they're open to misinterpretation, I think. For example, you could say, we rival the great forces of nature. Okay, so one of the great forces of nature are tides, and the energy produced by tides is usually greater than the energy by humans, for example. But in terms of shifting the Earth system, we are miles greater actually than a lot of forces. Tides are net zero; they don't change the rate of change of the Earth system. Well, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, because when I was thinking about these statements we were making, I thought, well, is there a way we could formalize a statement around the Anthropocene that communicates more specifically the impact of humans? And so as I was thinking about it, I was thinking particularly about the rate of change of the Earth system, the speed the Earth system is changing, a bit like a car is going at 50 miles an hour or 100 miles an hour. So the miles per hour is the rate of change. So I thought the Earth system rate of change is something good, because we can look at this. Something we can measure the various components of. The biodiversity is part of the Earth system, changes to the ice sheets, changes to the oceans, changes to biogeochemistry, changes to the atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases, the key components of the Earth system that keep it functioning. We can measure the rate of change there for each one of those, and compare that to a baseline, and be able to say then what are the key drivers of that rate of change now. So that was really the starting point. That's why I thought we needed something like this.
So with this updated formula, can we now know what rate of human influence can continue and still allow a relatively safe habitable space on this planet?
Yeah, so our conclusion, maybe I could take us through the equations very briefly, because basically we start off with, for the last 4 billion years since Earth has had a biosphere, a sort of living resource on Earth, the rate of change of the Earth system has been a function of astronomical forces, the Earth's orbit around the sun, geophysical forces, volcanic eruptions and tectonic movements, and internal dynamics as, you know, new species evolve or as the system settles or moves into to new states. And so now we're saying that back in 1999, an academic, Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber from Potsdam Institute, he published a paper saying that, well, now you have to include humans in here because humans are now a major driver. And so the rate of change of the Earth system is not just a function of astronomical and geophysical forces and these internal dynamics. It's also human forces. But he published that paper just 1 year before Paul Crutzen and Eugene Stürmer suggested that we were now in the Anthropocene, and 5 years before this book I mentioned earlier in 2004, when the Earth system and global change showing the great accelerations, and a decade before the first publication of the Planetary Boundaries paper. So when you look at the evidence in those papers and compare the current rate of change of the Earth system caused by humans compared with the background rate over the last 7,000 years, for example, you see that humans absolutely dwarf all other forcings by several orders of magnitude in most cases, from biodiversity to climate change to ocean acidification. So we can say that now the rate of change of the Earth system is a function of humans. The other forcings are still there, but their orders of magnitude smaller, so they don't play a big role in the equation at all. I mean, you can discount them currently. That might change in the next few weeks if we had a massive, you know, Toba-like super eruption. But you know, currently, we can say, you know, for the last 40 years that's been the case.
So in the conclusion of this paper, it says, quote, "It remains unclear whether anthropogenic forcing is significant enough to drive the Earth system into a greenhouse state. That surprises me a little from some scientists I've interviewed. I thought our entry into a greenhouse state is more or less a given. What is the hope of avoiding it?"
Okay, so when we talk about a greenhouse state, we're talking about a state with very little ice on Earth. And these they have had these stable states before where carbon dioxide levels have been very, very high. And we've had, you know, hippopotamus on the poles. And there's and palm trees and, you know, lush forests there, and you know, sea levels would be, you know, at least 70 meters higher than today, and the Earth would be operating in a very, very different way. There's you know, some scientists, James Hansen, formerly at NASA, and others have said that yes, we could have this runaway warming to pull us into that state, but the jury's out whether whether we can burn enough fossil fuels to fully do that, to fully tip us over into that that state. And we don't really know enough. You know, as I said earlier, we've sort of reduced the resilience of the Earth system through biodiversity loss and you know, changing the nitrogen cycle and water cycle. We're pumping out greenhouse gases, and we're in this no analog state. We can't say for certain what can happen. The big concern is that as temperatures get warmer, then the carbon sinks. So we pump out, you know, 10 gigatons of carbon every year. 5 gigatons of that carbon stays in the atmosphere, and it's cumulative. It stays there for thousands of years, so it just builds up and up and up as we emit more. But 5 gigatons is absorbed by the oceans and the land, so around 2.5 each. And these are really super important carbon sinks. They provide a huge service to industrialized societies. Yet, in a warmer world, will they remain carbon sinks, or will they become carbon sources? Is a big open question. And what will tip them? And you know, there's some research out just before Christmas saying that even the warmer world we have at the currently, at we're 1 degree above pre-industrial, heading rapidly towards 1.5. The research showed that by 2050, as we get to 1.5 and above, then carbon in soils will start getting emitted to the atmosphere, so causing more of a problem. And as we potentially hit other tipping points in the Earth system, you know, when we get to 3 degrees above pre-industrial, then we see places like the Amazon potentially dying back and becoming a savanna and emitting large amounts of carbon. So you get these carbon feedbacks, these positive feedback loops where, you know, a warmer world begets an even warmer world. then potentially pulling you into this this hothouse attractor, where it'd be, even if you stopped emitting greenhouse gases, you have this concern that the system itself is going to pull you naturally towards these this new basin of attraction. So, and this is you know, alarming. We don't have enough information on exactly what will cause these kind of state changes, but we are taking risks as we wander into the unknown.
Well, I've used up quite a bit of your time. I hope you have just a couple more minutes. I want to ask you, as we finish off, about your views on the pivotal role of Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber, or John as he's known in the UK. Where does he stand in this exploration?
So John is extremely concerned about where we're heading politically. I think that in 2015, we made huge progress with the Paris Agreement on climate, with the Sustainable Development Goals. And there was huge, huge momentum and huge amount of energy. And that momentum is continuing. I think we have, the world is rapidly beginning to decarbonize. And the Global Carbon Project, one of Future Earth's projects that I'm affiliated with, we've shown that for the last 3 years, the growth in emissions has stalled. So there's been a huge, huge effort to address our fossil fuel emissions. I should say the growth in emissions of fossil fuels. And that's unexpected, actually. The scientists didn't think this could happen. They hadn't predicted it. And it's largely down to China's huge efforts to control its emissions, to move rapidly away from coal. And then you can see sort of knock-on effects of that, of coal companies in Australia and the U.S. who are betting on China's increase in coal use. These companies are going bankrupt. We've seen 6 bankruptcies of the major coal companies in the U.S. since 2012, and the U.S. as well. It has been reducing its emissions, making big progress there. So there are some positive signs that we can deal with this, but will it happen fast enough? Emissions really need to peak by 2020 at the latest, and then fall precipitously to 2015. We're talking about some sort of we need a carbon law of halving emissions every decade from 2020, 2030, 2040 to 2050 to get down to zero as rapidly as possible.
We've been talking with Owen Gaffney. He's a science communicator for the Future Earth Project at futureearth.org. Owen also directs media and strategy for the Stockholm Resilience Center. All the while, he makes his own contribution to science through articles like this one, titled The Anthropocene Equation. Find links to all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Owen Gaffney, thank you so much for your explanations. It really helps.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. In recent years, extremely dangerous and damaging fires have dominated the news in many parts of the world. Just last month, a major forest fire ripped through Chile. Last year, the oil sand city of Fort McMurray, Canada, was almost destroyed. Are mega fires increasing? Will we see even more as the world warms? There's new research out about that. The title of a paper published February 6, 2017, in the journal Nature is Human Exposure and Sensitivity to Globally Extreme Wildfire Events. We've reached the lead author, Dr. David Bowman. David Bowman is professor of environmental change biology at the University of Tasmania School of Plant Science. He's a visiting fellow or adjunct professor at 3 other Australian universities. From Hobart, Tasmania, David Bowman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, hi. How are you going?
Oh, it's going pretty good here. Now, before we get to the science, David, you have a personal reason for studying fires. Could you tell us about that?
That's right. On the 7th of February, 1967, an extreme fire event occurred that engulfed really the whole of the Hobart area and very nearly burnt the city down. And that event, the 1967 event, really was what I was brought up with. I was trained by a Tasmanian fire ecologist, and there weren't many in those days. And his life was completely shaped by the 1967 event, you know, when you have motor vehicles melted and suburbs severely impacted and so on, and 64 people dying in a small community, isolated community in those days, it still actually leaves a tremendous legacy. And part of the commemoration is that people from 50 years ago who were kids are still traumatized by what we call the 1967 Black Tuesday fire.
That is amazing, and I know what you mean. It has a very big impact. I've done some programs on super fires, and other people call them mega fires, but until now there really hasn't been a standard of what that means. What does your paper suggest as a good name and then as a measurement?
Well, that's right. We in the fire science community have been using the word mega fire, but there's been some discomfiture about the use of the word because it's very difficult to define. Is it a very intense fire? Is it a very big fire? Is it a very destructive fire? Is it a very historically anomalous fire? There are lots of ways a fire could be really big, a mega fire. What we did was two things. Firstly, we settled on the idea of energy as being a good index of fire, an extreme fire, and we avoided in our paper the use of the word megafire because it's an ambiguous term, and also the way we calculated these extreme fire events, we're not able to necessarily say it is a single fire, because as you know, during these extreme fire events, you may have several fire fronts, and firefighters may call each one of those fire fronts a separate name, as now it's becoming the custom that we generally name major fires. And so you could have several fires burning in a region, each one almost with its own individual character. And what we did was put a lattice down across the world, a 10 by 10 kilometre lattice, and then we looked at the energy of the hotspots detected by the MODIS satellite. The whole basis of the paper and our database was to say, well, if you sum all of those hotspots in a small area, that's a fire event. And then if you rank all of the fires we could observe in a 12-year period, some 23 million. And then what we did is we chopped off the top 500 and said, well, in anybody's language, the top 500 out of 23 million have got to be extreme. And then we studied those fires in detail to develop, I guess, a sample of extreme fires. Now, had we had more time, it's extremely time-consuming to attribute all of those 500 fires because we don't have an international database on fires. If we had an international database on fires, our paper would have been entirely redundant. We would have just somebody would have already analysed that database, but it doesn't exist. There's no national, internationally agreed, and in many cases, no nationally agreed fire records. Some countries have better fire records than others. And what we were hungering for was an international perspective, because as many of your listeners would know, if you're interested in the environment, you over the last 10 or 15 years, we're having reports of unusual fires, fires in Israel, and you go, that's odd, I didn't know they had forest fires in Israel, or fires in Greece, or fires in France, or fires in Chile, or fires in Australia, which I guess people know, but then extremely crazy fires in Australia, and then lots of them. So you need a global perspective to make sense of what's going on, and that's what our study did, and we used the index of intensity, and we looked at the most extreme events. And it would have been tremendous if we had more time. We would have looked at 5,000 or 10,000 events, but attributing them was a manual process. It was a painstaking verification process because we had to filter out events that also release flashes of energy, like volcanoes.
How did you do that? How could you verify that this flash of energy you saw was really a fire?
Well, we had a flow diagram, a verification process that we followed. And the way you verify these events is you need independent data streams. And so in the case of is it a fire, the first thing you do is you look at the spectral properties of the energy, and we know that a forest fire will have a particular spectral signature. You then look at other satellite data, particularly area burnt data, and using other satellites indeed, and then you go, well, at that location around that time or after that time, we can see a fire scar on the landscape. So that gives you a tick. And so you have to go through and be certain that there really was a fire. And then the next thing we did, which fed into this, is we wanted to know off our 500, and we winnowed it down to about 460, we rejected a number of them because they weren't verifiable as forest fires. We then wanted to know whether they were economically or socially destructive. And that was helpful also to verify they were fires, because generally really big fire events get reported in the media, and all of these fire events, if you will, had an address. And so we could search the web for reports in the media, or indeed in government, for fires at a particular time, at a particular location or near a particular town. And then we were able to, again, verify that it was a fire and also attribute whether it was destructive to human values.
Of course, there are some terrible fires in Siberia that aren't reported, and nobody has reporters in the Congo where there's civil wars and such. So it's possible that some important events could be left out or not.
Well, certainly in the boreal zone or in remote areas, even in outback Australia, believe it or not, we saw some extreme fires, and there's a reason for those extreme fires. We would be able to verify they were fires for sure, because our verification process, you can't disguise a fire scar in the boreal, you know, and that particularly hangs around for years. So we would be able to verify they were fires. Whether they killed people or disrupted infrastructure really got down to what was reported in the web and whether it was translatable from maybe Russian into English and interpretable in a way that you could attribute destruction. So we don't claim that we have a comprehensive, and I think in a sense, this is sort of one of the shocking features of our work. We don't claim we have a comprehensive database. Nobody does. That's shocking to me. Something as important as destructive forest fires, there isn't a global database. But we do have a very reliable sample, which enabled us to do what we call pyrogeographic analyses, or the understanding the geography of these fires.
And then you do undertake to discuss which are disasters in human terms and which are possibly natural wildfires, or at least not that damaging to humans per se. So what are the criteria that qualify these fires as a disaster?
The criteria that qualify disaster is economic impact, loss of life, or declaration of an emergency by the government in general terms. So it's something that humans care about. I think there's an important point here is that not all of these highly energetic fires are disastrous for humans. So there are big fires burning out in the backcountry. Now, they may be ecologically disastrous, and they may be contributing to carbon pollution, and they may be contributing to smoke pollution, which is affecting cities. And we didn't consider that. We just considered the direct impact on people and on people's livelihoods, infrastructure, and so on. So there's two important points here. One is that there are these fires out there that are having an effect, but they're not having a direct effect. But also, these disastrous fires, which we were able to, as a subset, had a different geography to the background highly extreme events that we're talking about, this top 500. And they are concentrated generally in two places, the west of the North America, and particularly in the US, and the south of Australia. They're the real core areas, and emerging concern will be the Mediterranean. So there's something about those places, and it turns out it's climate, vegetation, so you've got the right climate, the right vegetation, but most importantly, the right settlement patterns. And the way you get a really good disastrous fire in the main, or to get this concentration of disastrous fires, is you create a combustible inhabited landscape, which is you intermix houses and the bush. And in fact, if you sort of, you know, think of what I'm saying, you know, that's like one way of saying it as a precursor to a disastrous fire. Another way of saying it, that's a really nice place to live. And there's the problem that as people get wealthy, they want to live outside the cities and they want to live with the amenity value of forests. Forests are, you know, very beautiful, peaceful places. People want privacy and clean air and so on. So they literally build into these forests. You know, we've all seen photographs of this. They're sort of grafting suburban existence into these forested landscapes without really any consideration of the ecology of these landscapes. And then there's, you know, of course, the hullabaloo when the fires come and burn down houses. And unfortunately, we're seeing in the Mediterranean this, I sometimes think of it as a socio-ecological pathology, because it's like all of these natural hazard crises, people building on floodplains when they know it's a floodplain because that's where floods occur. And then you say, oh, well, we'll build a flood barrier, and that makes it even more desirable to live there. So in the fire equivalents, we'll have better and better technology to put fires out. But then eventually the flood barrier breaks, or the fire technology can't cope with fires of such phenomenal intensity, and that's when you get death and destruction. And unfortunately, in the Mediterranean, due to land use changes, the traditional intensive landscapes, which didn't carry extreme fires, have become really quite dramatically overgrown with flammable vegetation. And simultaneously, there's, because of rural drift into the cities, poorer people, rural people, have been attracted to the cities, changing land use and economic policy. And then richer people are saying, well, I want to get out of the city. And so they go and start building back into these landscapes that used to have more traditional agriculture. And before you know it, in a bizarre sort of irony, the Mediterranean is becoming like the Western US and Southern Australia in terms of having a fire management crisis.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is Dr. David Bowman from the University of Tasmania. We're talking about human exposure to extreme wildfire events. Yes, the Mediterranean. Now, science suggests the climate of the Mediterranean will become hotter and drier, more like that of North Africa. I wonder, will that climate change add to the sort of human landscape risk that you've just described?
Well, that's right. We did a very simplistic climate future analysis, and it's simplistic. Projecting fire risk into the future is extremely difficult, because it involves not only climate, but also involves the biology, the landscape ecology, and it also involves human ignitions and human settlement patterns. What we did is that we said, well, we know there's a threshold in the fire weather index where you get most, above this threshold, you get most extreme fire events. So that was sort of like a benchmark. And then we looked at each cell around globally, and we took some agreed projections, and of course they are projections, they're not predictions of future climate, and then counted up the number of days, the percent increase above that threshold into the future, so the mid of this century. And the alarming news is that it's certainly not going to get any better, but we're seeing between a 20 to 50% increase in the number of days where you could carry an extreme fire, and certainly the Mediterranean, right across the Mediterranean, jumps out as a place where we're going to see a real stepping up of fire risk. And this is, you know, completely consistent with many other studies. You know, there's now actually quite a burgeoning research field in Mediterranean fire ecology, because this is already beginning to play out. They're beginning to see extreme fire events. And, of course, we know about the heat waves in Europe and so on. So, you know, and in fact, that's what we're having right now in this summer in Australia and the mainland. We're seeing heat waves in the central east coast of Australia, particularly around Sydney and up into Brisbane. And one of the things our study suggested is this sort of further expansion of extreme fires up the east coast of Australia. And sure enough, this summer we're seeing quite a lot of significant fire activity to the north of Brisbane and affecting suburbs and making national news. So again, I would reiterate, you know, we're not in the business of predictions. These are pragmatic estimations of risk, lots of constraints, and there's lots of extra finessing you could do with this, but it basically completely consistent with what everybody is saying, and there's a simple reason for why it's consistent with what everybody's saying, and that is that the precursor, one of the things our study showed is that the precursor to extreme fire events is anomalous extreme weather events, particularly heat, but also stronger winds, dryness. Those things all converge to create the recipe, if you will, for extreme fire events.
You know, you're reminding me of a conversation I had with the Canadian fire expert Mike Flanagan, and my question to him was that climate scientists were saying the boreal forests, the northern forests of Canada, are going to get wetter and wetter as some areas further south get drier and drier. But we were seeing more forest fires up there. So I asked him, well, how can you have more forest fires if the area is getting wetter? And he said the answer is thin northern soil. It only takes 3 hot days, the kind of weather you've just talked about, for that soil to dry out, and then you can have a fire fairly soon after the rains. So, you know, it seems like it doesn't take a big change in climate to make a big difference for how long the fire season will run or the kind of fires we'll get.
Well, that's right. And an example, actually, of this, what we call antecedent or the preceding conditions. In Australia, in the outback, we can get extreme fires if you have a wet season, like we've had in some parts of the outback this summer. You get a lot of rain, and that makes basically the outback, which is generally arid, like the tropics, because it's really warm and wet, and you get an incredible production of biomass. Now, of course, it during the dry season, it switches back to being very hot and dry, and normally you don't get a lot of fire up there because there's no biomass, because it's a desert, if you will. It's an arid environment, so it's low vegetation productivity. But when you get this extra rainfall, you can get a pulse of fine fuels. And then, you know, if you get a hot, dry season, you can get these spectacularly big fires, which will burn across the core of the continent. So that's exactly right. It's a very paradoxical situation that even wet springs in southern Australia, we have the same problem like we've had this last spring, where it's been very wet. You get a lot of production of fine fuels, and then it's really a waiting game, and we're in exactly that place here in Tasmania. It's been a very warm, consistently warm summer, but no heat waves yet. So everything is just sort of on simmer, but there's this huge pool of hot air on the continent, which is actually currently being vented out into Sydney. So, you know, the city of Sydney and Brisbane have been having these, you know, just stupendously historic, you know, unbearable heat, you know, really affecting the headlines and city life. But were that heat to be channeled southward into Tasmania, even this fire season, we could see trouble. And part of the reason for trouble is because we've got so much fine fuel from the wet spring.
I remember seeing those pictures of fires in Tasmania where there was a family huddled around a dock while the whole sky blazed above them. But at that same time, there was a much less reported fire in northern Tasmania, was there not? And it was an important preservation area. Could you tell us about that?
Well, it's actually in the west. So Tasmania is it's an intriguing island that it's basically split on the western side. It's very, very low density. And it's a little bit like a miniature boreal sort of situation. It's got organic soils, some dense forests, some, like, you know, open boggy vegetation, which is, you know, I guess, almost analogous to a tundra. And that vegetation will burn only when it's extremely dry. And what happened is in the last 4 years, in 2013, when there was a very hot extreme fire event, which actually the Dunalley fire event, which the family hiding under the pier, was in our top 500 database. As that happened, there was a giant fire occurring in Western Tasmania under these very severe weather conditions. And that really highlights, I think, a key point that you can have an extreme destructive fire. The city of Dunalley, or the township of Dunalley, was basically destroyed, and people were running for their lives, jumping into the sea. I mean, truly incredible story. But on the other side of the island, where nobody lives, there was just this huge fire. It was, in Tasmanian terms, it was 46,000 hectares, and nobody was fighting it. It just was burning, and it was burning into the peat, and the smoke was coming out of the that wilderness into Hobart, polluting the atmosphere. And then what happened last fire season, the 2016 fire season, an extraordinarily dry spring, just a ridiculously dry spring, historically truly off the wall. Lightning storms ignited about 90 fires in the west, and they burnt for 60 days, and they were burning into wilderness areas which have some Gondwanic vegetation, relic vegetation, really weird Gondwanic ancestors to the giant redwood pines and all sorts of curious and odd plants that of which there are fossils in Antarctica. I mean, these are really, you know, some of these things have been unchanged for almost 100 million years. You know, they're very unusual vegetation, which can't withstand fire at all. These environments were actually under threat because of the incredibly huge and slow burning, because it was in the peat, in the organic soils, burning fires. But that wouldn't qualify, according to our definition, as an extreme fire. It didn't. Maybe there was a few occasions where it might have been an extreme fire, but most of it was actually slow moving, just under the influence of extreme drought.
Now, in this paper, you make another really important point. We're going to have to wrap up soon, but you say that cities recognize earthquake risk. They make bylaws. We spend a lot of money to reduce earthquake damage and prepare the population, but we don't do the same for fire, and especially with climate disruption coming. What can we do to make our cities more fireproof, or at least help the population escape if they need to?
Well, there's absolutely a huge amount of information about how to make cities more fireproof. I've had the privilege of visiting Vancouver. And again, Vancouver is sort of like, in my mind, a giant version of Hobart. It's a city, particularly the north side of Vancouver, it's a city which is going to get really hammered by an extreme fire event. It's got all of the symptoms of people building into vegetation that can support fire. They have no experience of fire. There's an aversion to clearing around houses because people want amenity value. And even the Canadian government has provided, the British Columbian government have provided funding to clear around communities. There's very limited uptake because there's, in other words, we've got all of the knowledge to make, or not all of, but most of the knowledge we have to make cities and settlements significantly more fireproof. But that requires changing the landscape. And the biggest break on this is actually the appetite in the community for that change. Because it's contrary to what most people are living in these places. They don't want to see the forest thinned out. They don't want to see fuel treatment. They don't want to spend the money on making their houses fireproof. They're living in la-la land, really, that we're just, you know, thinking, and same thing in Hobart. We're just sort of winging it. And we go, yeah, we know 50 years ago Hobart nearly burnt down, but, you know, we're really going to fight tooth and nail if somebody starts trying to, you know, do interventions which are going to cost money or affect the amenity value of my suburb or my backyard or whatever. So, It's basically being put in the too hard basket socially, and my prediction is that the only way we break through this is, and maybe even that is, we have to have an event, another event like the 1967 event in Hobart, to really get this right at the very top of the political agenda. Even the Dunalley fire, there was a government inquiry, there was lots of improvements in fire management and so on, but it's getting it to be stuck onto the community. We know that there's a large, from surveys and inquiries, we know there's a large number of people living in a place like Hobart that just are in denial. They just don't believe the message. They don't want to hear the message. So it's not so much a lack of technology or lack of knowledge. It's actually getting the community engaged. And I think the tragedy with climate change denial is that we've already got a really bad problem, which would be existing even if it wasn't for climate change. But climate change is making a bad problem much worse. But in a sense, the denial aspect of it almost works in the opposite direction of getting adaptation, because people will say, oh, well, you know, it's not really certain that there is climate change. And then once you introduce doubt into all of this conversation and you already are inclined not to do anything, then it plays to your advantage. You know, you want to hear what you want to hear. And so you go, well, there's no problem, so we'll just keep living dangerously, and people aren't even aware they are living dangerously until you have something like a Fort McMurray event where you go, that just wasn't meant to happen. But translating the anger and the grief from these events into adaptive responses, that's a really big project.
Well, we'll see whether we can do it with climate change. As you say, it's human resistance. And I did a program with a person who said that human denial was just a part of the way our brains evolved, and it's very difficult to get rid of. So I think we're going to have to wrap it up there, David. It's been really fascinating talking with you. We've been discussing the paper, Human Exposure and Sensitivity to Globally Extreme Wildfire Events, and that was published in the journal Nature on February 6, 2017. Our guest is the lead author. I'll put links to this paper and other fire interviews on Radio EcoShock in my show blog at ecoshock.org. That comes out on Wednesdays. David Bowman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, pleasure. Good on you. Thanks.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
In America, the man who swore to dismantle the Environmental Protection Agency has been approved to head it. The last of the EPA staff from Obama days have established a mirror site to preserve the climate change and species information provided formerly by that agency. Meanwhile, in Berkeley, teams of young people have downloaded reams of databases from NASA. They've also set up software to track changes and deletions by the Trump administration. That's it. We are reduced to saving what we can before the new dark age of denial. But we know what time it is on the big clock. Our planet is weaving out into a new form, heading through floods, fires, and storms towards the gate of mass extinction. Our children and descendants are in danger. I will continue to bring you cutting-edge science, activism, and information you need to know. Please pass it on as far and as wide as you can. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock and caring about our world. The last word goes to troubadour David Rovics at davidrovics.com. Let's make the planet Earth great again.
We could take on other issues, like the survival of our race, by which I mean the bipeds on this floating rock in space. The most invasive species anywhere around, the one that keeps on burning everything that can be found, the one that will get it together in the nick of time and then make the planet Earth great again. Stop spending money on antiquated technology such as tanks and missiles, most other things military. We can use those vast resources to to make us all safe and sound. Windmills in the air, coal and oil in the ground. We can be the envy of the rest of the galaxy when we make the planet Earth great again.
Tired of cheerleaders and phony media issues?
We treat climate change almost as if it's something external. It's a sort of problem that we've created that we can solve with human genius. But I don't think it is. I think climate change is our society. Climate change is who we are.
Looking for the awful truth? Dig in with Alex Smith. Top scientists, authors, and activists, the ones you want to hear. No fear, Deep Green Radio EcoShock. Join us.
Now, we've got two matters here we want to talk. Phil, we want to talk to you about the question of the engineer in the terrible case of the loss of life there in Quebec. You'd fill us in on that.
Well, as people remember, there was a runaway train that plowed into the town of Lake Megantic in July of 2013 with much loss of life and the destruction of the town. The train had been parked on the top of a hill that overlooked the town. And for a variety of reasons, none of them acceptable, the brakes were not set and the train started to roll and there was nobody manning the train. Mm-hmm. And so the engineer of that train, Tom Harding, and when I say the engineer, he was the conductor, the engineer, and the brakeman, and everything else. He has been charged with criminal negligence causing death. And there was a development in his criminal trial this past week in which he had been planning to argue for a stay of proceedings because of abuse by the police and because of delay in bringing it to trial following a recent Supreme Court of Canada judgment. They have decided not to proceed with those arguments because they say they have such an excellent case to defend themselves. And he'd rather defend himself and explain what happened and say that mm-hmm. he doesn't have criminal responsibility. So okay. And that's where it stands. The trial is going to take place sometime this year in 2017.
And a big question for other Canadians is, what is the rail system been changed at all since that time?
Well, I think they've made some cosmetic changes, but has there been a change in thinking on the people who profit from owning railways and running trains on them? They might have been a little tinkering with some of the operating rules, but the idea that you can run a train with one person on the crew who has to leave that train in a hurry because he's got to get to the hotel to get enough sleep to take a train in the opposite direction in the morning, I don't think anybody is challenging that, to use the word they like to use, business model. No. I think in fact, they're looking to use less and less people. I mean, I remember when it was a big fight when they wanted to go from five people on a train to four people on a train. And the union said it wasn't safe. Now they're down to
actually,
one.
Actually, they're talking about
like
nobody.
Zero. Yeah, they are.
Nobody.
Yeah.
Right? No one on the
no
train.
One on the train, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a happy sight. Here comes the 87 cars loaded with something dangerous, and don't worry, there's nobody aboard. Good. Well, Phil, thanks for that. Now, the trial starts when?
They still haven't set a date, but it will be this year.
Yeah. This is the Taylor Report, CITUT, 89.5 FM. I want to say something about this. This issue of the Americans are now embroiled with Russophobia, I guess is one word. There's no dispute in Putin or whatever. This is an old issue, and they ought to share with us the fact that they've played this in Western politics for a long time. And to my mind, what happened with Hillary Clinton is she had what I would call her Zinoviev letter moment. In 1924, there was going to be a close election. The Labour Party had just barely gotten into power for the first time in history. And they indicated that they were going to be friendly to Russia and just they're going to start trying to get to know the Soviet Union. And this is 1924. The leader was Ramsay MacDonald. It was going to be a close election. Everybody understood. So 4 days before the election, The Daily Mail, no friend of labor, put out a headline story that they've gotten into possession of a letter from Gregory Zinoviev, a Bolshevik leader, congratulating the comrades in Britain on the developments with Ramsay MacDonald and saying, well, boy, this is great. Now we're going to have wonderful things happen, you see, for the World Revolutionary Movement and all this. And, it had some impact. To this day, nobody's sure what happened. I mean, but it seemed to – the notion at the time was it threw the election towards Mr. Stanley Baldwin and the conservatives. And MacDonald, who lost – did I get his name right? Ramsay MacDonald. He decided that he'd been beaten by the Zinoviev letter. And now you have to understand, the Zinoviev letter was a fraud. It was historians have decided that it was somebody planted it. It had the look of something real. Mr. Baldwin came in as a result of playing that card. And I remind you, Hillary played the Putin card. She thought she wanted to run against Putin. You could tell in the last weeks of the campaign, it was her versus Putin. Unfortunately, Putin beat her. I mean, that's the part that they haven't figured out. It seems smart. And matter of fact, I thought, well, that's going to work, you know, because you count on xenophobia and parochialism in American culture and all that, and this foreigner. And then she had the little hacking story. They thought, well, this is going to be our Baldwin moment. We're going to walk in there. And I thought they were going to walk in based on this kind of stuff. But it was this is a case of trying to use and indeed manufacture something. They have the similar thing now. They got a big noise, but they don't have any evidence. And in fact, the places where she got beat, the issue was rather clear. This trade matter and job issues was obviously a killer, just as we're seeing with Brexit and all these other things. People are getting really restive. It's this idea that we know best, et cetera. And so I just remind everybody, in 1924, the Zinoviev letter. Incidentally, historians now, these studies have shown that it was concocted in the British Intelligence Organization, and then someone gave it to the Daily Mail. Now, that decision would have been an interesting one, who gave it to the Daily Mail, but that's how they did it. They cooked it. It's a phony letter. Zinoviev laughed about it. He said, this is a joke. But, of course, who would listen to Zinoviev? It's like Putin today says, it's a joke. And everybody says, oh, well, yeah, but that's Putin. This was a something which they thought, in the case of the British at that time, it may have worked, although they pointed out that MacDonald basically lost because he had a very narrow hold on office and people were nervous about a Labour. This is something new, a Labour Party. But when they talk this way, I mean, let us remember that, you know, that this is an old trick of trying to say, oh, an outsider is trying to affect you, an evil outsider, of course. And in the case of Zinoviev, it was a joke, which is and now we're seeing, in my opinion, it repeated with Hillary. Again, the intelligence people were involved. Oh, yes, one other detail I want to make sure I mention is Mr. Baldwin, of course, after being elected, he had an investigation done, and the investigation came back and said, yes, the Zinoviev letter was real. And so, they confirmed, except that another 2 or 3 years went by, and then MI5, British Intelligence, came forward and said, actually, no, it was a fake. We don't know who faked it, but it was a fake. But meanwhile, he's already gotten in office. So they start this stuff. One last detail here on this matter, because the Canadian media has completely joined in with we have to hate Putin. Jean Chrétien, just 1 week before Justin Trudeau was elected, Chrétien said he thought it was good that Russia had entered the conflict in Syria And he thought it was a good that there should be an alliance against ISIS in Syria involving Russia. People don't remember that. Now they're all – everybody's saying, well, you know, the evil Russian. They're forgetting. That was – the Liberal Party was floating that idea because, frankly, the public agrees with it. What you have is a narrow leadership base that doesn't want this policy.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Norman Salomon, co-founder and coordinator of the online organization RootsAction.org, who discusses the petition drive underway to initiate an impeachment investigation into President Trump's business practices. Matt Wood, policy director with the group Free Press, who examines the new direction of Donald Trump's Federal Communications Commission and the plan to scrap net neutrality. And Fatima Rojas, a leader of the Connecticut group Unidad Latina en Acción, who talks about her group's outreach effort to immigrant communities, living in fear of Donald Trump's mass deportation plan. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A Senate committee in Australia's parliament is preparing a consensus same-sex marriage bill that includes limited rights for clergy to refuse to bless gay unions, but rejects a broad conscientious objector clause. Gay rights activists pushing for the consensus bill are seeking support from moderate members of the ruling Liberal Party, in addition to opposition Labour and Green Party members. Yet the legislation still faces resistance from the Liberal Party's Conservative Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, who had pledged to hold a national plebiscite on same-sex marriage. Longtime marriage equality advocate Rodney Croom praised the consensus bill for rejecting outright discrimination against same-sex couples and showing marriage equality is possible when our elected officials work across party lines. If passed, the bill would require civil celebrants to marry any couple who has the right to get married. However, clergy would retain the right to refuse to conduct same-sex marriage ceremonies on the basis of religious doctrine. After years of rapid economic growth, Singapore has among the lowest fertility rates in the world, 1.24 births per woman, far below the rate necessary to maintain a stable population. During decades of fear about a population explosion, Singapore and other emerging Asian nations made intensive family planning a priority. Now, with an aging workforce, Singapore is paying subsidies to young couples to defray the cost of raising children. Young families get priority in housing allotments, and Singapore's government has also begun sponsoring a dating service. In 2015, the most recent year with available statistics, more than 33,000 children were born in Singapore, the highest number in more than a decade. According to the Christian Science Monitor, developed nations ranging from Denmark to Japan are coming to terms with shrinking populations and increased budget demands to care for aging citizens. Many advocates for the poor question the reliability of the biennial street census of homeless people across the U.S. Critics say the census, taken by volunteers on a single night with little more than a clipboard, pencil, and flashlight, is flawed and likely substantially inaccurate. Supporters of the homeless count say it is vital for communities to get a sense of trends of people living on the street. University of Pennsylvania researcher Dennis Culhane told The Guardian newspaper, "The bottom line is that the count is imperfect, but I don't know if we could do a better job." Recent single-night homeless counts have found nearly 550,000 homeless people across America. But Culhane also says federal officials are aware these figures only provide a snapshot. While the count identifies around 500,000 homeless Americans on a given night, Culhane uses data extrapolations to estimate that some 2 million Americans experience homelessness at some point over the course of a year. In recent years, the scale of homelessness has spiked, particularly in western states, including California, Nevada, Oregon, and Hawaii. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The first month of Donald Trump's presidency has been rocked by chaotic White House mismanagement of a series of events, including investigations into the Trump campaign's links with Russian government officials, the sloppy and unconstitutional rollout of the so-called Muslim ban that was successfully overturned in federal court, the firing of Michael Flynn as national security advisor for lying to the vice president, and a constant stream of lies and misinformation coming from both the president and his spokespersons. With the worst public approval ratings of any new U.S. president in modern American history, and a burgeoning protest movement that has seen the mobilization of literally millions of people in opposition to the Trump agenda, the situation looks pretty bleak for a president who's supposed to be in his honeymoon period. Now, two organizations, RootsAction.org and Free Speech for People, have collected and delivered over 850,000 petition signatures to Congress, calling on legislators in the House of Representatives to initiate an impeachment investigation into President Trump's business dealings that appear to violate the U.S. Constitution's foreign and domestic emoluments clauses and other federal law. Those constitutional provisions prohibit the president from personally profiting from his position beyond his government salary. Representative Gerald Nadler, a Democrat of New York, has filed a resolution of inquiry to the Justice Department, asking officials there to provide to Congress any information they have relating to any violation of the Constitution by Mr. Trump, which could be the first step in Congress toward impeachment. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, co-founder and coordinator of the online organization RootsAction.org, who discusses the petition drive underway to initiate an impeachment investigation into President Trump's business ethics.
Really, there are so many people who have a wide range of concerns, to put it mildly, alarm, anger, willingness and eagerness to push back against the Trump presidency. And in that mix, and necessarily, we have to be on defense to defend the gains that people have won over 20, 30 years and more. I think it's also important for us to take the offense on the question of legality of this presidency. And there is the Constitution of the United States that has two clauses known as the Foreign Emoluments Clause and Domestic Emoluments Clause that require the kind of lack of conflict of interest that, in fact, President Trump is totally in violation of. And so that's it in a nutshell. At ImpeachDonaldTrumpNow.org, we have 880,000 signers on a petition for the initiation of a impeachment process in the Congress.
Norman, just spell out in a little bit more detail, what are the grounds upon which this petition is based to launch an impeachment effort against Donald Trump? So early in his presidency, a lot of people will say, hey, has he really crossed the line yet?
Well, he crossed the line the moment he became president. And that's, I think, a very important point that our news media have not really been getting into. You know, the minority leader of the House, Nancy Pelosi, has said publicly, well, if the president violates the law, then we will look at impeachment. But in fact, the moment he became president, because of his refusal to set up anything approximating a blind trust, I call it a 2020 trust he has, he knows exactly what he's invested in, what the Trump Organization is invested in. He's been, from the very beginning of his presidency, in violation of these two key clauses of the Constitution. One forbids the president or a top official of the government from being financially entangled with a foreign government or entity. And the Trump Organization, you know, you can go to Saudi Arabia and the Philippines and Turkey, where there are huge investments that Trump has, which he has refused to divest himself from whatsoever. And then I think probably even more important is Article 2, Section 7 of the U.S. Constitution, the so-called Domestic Emoluments Clause or Presidential Compensation Clause, that singles out the president. There's no way that the Congress can waive this requirement. That part of the Constitution names the president as somebody who absolutely cannot benefit from any policies or entities of the 50 states of the United States or the U.S. government. And yet, whether you look at Trump Towers or you look at the new Trump Hotel opened right next to the White House, you have a situation where Trump personally and his family and his corporation are benefiting enormously from all sorts of tax breaks, waivers, leases, regulatory decisions of the states and of the federal government. So it's really a question, I think, Scott, of is the president above the law? And if we're going to give him a pass and say, well, for some reason or another, it doesn't matter that he has been violating the Constitution and continues to do so, then we're saying that the most powerful position in the U.S. government is held by somebody who is violating the Constitution 24/7, and that we're going to let that go. And I think that should be totally unacceptable.
There's been a recent public opinion poll asking the survey sample specifically about impeachment, and it turns out I think, as we all know, the country is quite polarized, and it was 46-46 for and against impeachment, with I guess about 8% who really didn't have an opinion yet. What does that poll say to you so early in a new president's term of office that we have the country split on the question of impeachment?
Well, for one thing, in a two-week period, the number went from 35% to 46% in support. So it says to me that the enthusiasm for impeachment is growing as people see what the Trump presidency actually means. It also says to me that there's an enormous gap, whether you talk about the members of the House from Connecticut or anywhere else in the country, an enormous gap between the viewpoints of people around the United States. As you noted, 46% support impeachment, willing to say so, and 0% of the members of the House of Representatives willing to say that they support impeachment. And this is classic. I really believe that it's true. When the people lead, the leaders will follow. At least the leaders can be made to follow. And this is an enormous gap that we need to close. And it doesn't mean that the grassroots needs to go along with the cowardice of people in Congress. It means people in Congress need to be compelled during their recess period and ongoing. They need to be compelled by hearing from constituents to step up to the plate and get impeachment done.
That was author and activist Norman Solomon, co-founder and coordinator of the online organization RootsAction.org. For more information on the campaign to impeach President Trump, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 26, 2015, the Federal Communications Commission voted in favor of a new regulation that reclassified broadband internet as a public utility under Title II of the Communications Act. The new rules that went into effect in June 2015 prohibited internet service providers, including cellular carriers, from blocking, slowing down, or speeding up online traffic, or giving priority to web services in exchange for payment. This regulatory doctrine, commonly known as net neutrality, had been at the heart of political battles since the 1990s. Now, just 21 months after net neutrality rules came into force, President Trump's newly appointed chair of the Federal Communications Commission, former Verizon attorney Ajit Pai, has taken quick action to reverse consumer protections initiated during President Obama's 8 years in office. A Republican appointee serving on the FCC for the past 3 years, Pai has long been an opponent of net neutrality. Upon being elevated to chair, he released a blizzard of actions that included halting 9 companies from providing discounted high-speed broadband internet service to low-income households, revoking a program to keep prison phone rates low, and discarding a proposal to require pay TV providers to make video programming available to the makers of third-party devices and software, saving consumers monthly cable box rental fees. Your reporter spoke with Matt Wood, policy director with the media democracy group FreePress.net, who examines the new direction of Donald Trump's FCC and the future of net neutrality under his chairman, Ajit Pai.
The FCC, there are 5 commissioners, but it is very much a top-down organization from the chair. The chair controls all of the other offices and bureaus within the commission. So it's probably fairest to think of it as a really steep pyramid with the chairman at the top of it, and the other 4 commissioners get votes, but they don't get to set the agenda. They're also, in addition to political pressure, though, are administrative law and court decisions and the legal framework within which the FCC has to act and the statutes that it's bound by that are passed by Congress. So I guess I would say, you know, we're optimistic about beating back these attacks, but we're not naive about how hard it's going to be. And as Chairman Pai has, I wouldn't say unlimited power, but lots of power to set the agenda, he has to then try to complete these tasks within the framework of the rulemakings and the other formal proceedings they have at the FCC. And those have to survive appellate review, as the net neutrality rules themselves did just last year when they went up and won in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So there are a lot of things constraining his ability to do all these bad things, including the people listening to this program who can make their views known at the FCC once again. but that doesn't mean he doesn't have a lot of ways to try to undo them over the coming weeks and months.
Just to review the mechanism for undoing net neutrality, for instance, is it a simple vote of the FCC, or does this have to go to a court for any kind of review, as I think you just indicated?
Well, both. So any federal agency can take a vote and try to make a rule or undo a rule. To get there, they have to have reasons for their decision-making. So it's not like they can just go in tomorrow and say, you know what, we've changed our mind and this is voting day. They have to ask questions. They have to take input from the public. Typically, if you look at the administrative laws that govern all these agencies, it's called notice and comment rulemaking. So the agency provides all of us with notice of what they intend to do, and we get a chance to comment. And there are other ways he can try to chip away at it. You know, they could issue some orders without really seeking comment, but that's not a very good way to survive court challenge. They could simply ignore the rules and not try to take them off the books, but refuse to enforce them. They could drop their defense of the rules that are still in court, because there's a small chance that the rules that are in place now will continue on their way through the appellate process and wind up in the Supreme Court, as a predecessor version of them did about a decade ago. So Chairman Pai will have lots of opportunities to either undo or chip away at the rules. We're not sure exactly which one of those he'll take. Personally, I don't think any of them are particularly appealing to him, because even though he has a strong ideology against these rules, they're very popular. What has become a partisan issue inside of D.C. and inside the Beltway here where I am is not really all that political outside of it. You know, most people, Democrat or Republican alike, don't want Comcast or AT&T telling them what they can do on the Internet. So I think he'll face a lot of opposition if he tries to really dismantle the rules. As I was saying earlier, whatever he does can be taken to a higher court, and we've seen that happen time again with the FCC. They haven't always won, and in fact, sometimes we've beaten them. But this last time around, we agreed with them about how they finally got to good net neutrality rules, and those did stand up in court just last June.
Well, Matt, just to wrap up here before we conclude, what are some of the strategies that your group, Free Press, and other allies will be looking into to mobilize opposition to some of these very major changes that this new FCC chair, with the support of Donald Trump, are going to be pushing?
Yeah, he's appointed by the president, and Donald Trump, who supposedly has a populist veneer. I have yet to really see it outside of Twitter rants, but you know, in theory, he's not supposed to be just doing what big corporations want. I don't think his cabinet has gotten the memo. Ajit Pai is also from a corporate background, and we're worried that he will try to basically do what's good for cable and phone companies and not for real people. All that said, he does have to do things within the law at the FCC, and then that has to pass muster in appellate court. And so we have legal filings we can make at the FCC to try to slow them down or convince them that the conclusions they might come to are wrong. We can sue them in court if we don't like the final decision. And then Congress is yet another playing field here where, you know, there might be people trying to change the law for the worst and taking power away from the FCC, or I guess in this context, giving Pai more power to do bad things. We'll fight them there as well. The key ingredient for all of that, I mean, other than the courts, which are a little bit more impervious to political pressure, we hope, but both in Congress and at the FCC, it's not just a matter of the filings that Free Press and other groups make. It really is a public comment, and has been for the last decade and a half or so. A key component of everything we do is helping real people to make their voices heard in these FCC proceedings, because they're, you know, something of a dry legal setting in some ways. But I think, as we've seen over the last few weeks of people calling their members of Congress and resisting a lot of the bad things coming out of this administration, that really matters. You know, people on the phones and sometimes even people in the streets, coupled with the lawyers' filings that we hope we can make pretty well down here from our offices in Washington. So it's really an all-of-the-above strategy. And you know, as I said, we're not naive about how hard it's going to be, but we are optimistic that people can win despite the power that this new administration is trying to exercise right out of the gate.
That was Matt Wood, policy director with the media democracy group Free Press. For more information on the fight to save net neutrality and related policies, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Thank you. Of all the many opponents of the Trump administration agenda, perhaps the most urgent and vocal is that of immigrants and their allies, who protest against Trump's promise to build a wall and deport most or all of the 11 million immigrants here without papers. The recent arrest of a young man in Washington state with legal status under DACA, or deferred action for childhood arrivals, sent a chill through the nation's undocumented immigrant community, as did the February 21st announcement by the Department of Homeland Security of new orders for stricter immigration enforcement. In Connecticut, dozens of rallies, marches, prayer vigils, and other actions have taken place in the months since Trump took office. Supporters have assisted immigrants to write testimony against legislation that would roll back their rights, and more than 300 recently attended a meeting in New Haven to learn how to accompany immigrants to their deportation hearings. Immigrants and their advocates are also reaching out to threatened communities to inform them of possible actions by the Federal Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and how they can protect themselves. On February 18th, volunteers fanned out around Fairhaven, a New Haven neighborhood with a large immigrant population. They spoke with more than 100 residents and business owners about the current threat. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Fatima Rojas, a leader of the pro-immigrant group Unidad Latina en Acción, who talks about her group's neighbor-to-neighbor outreach effort.
The goal of canvassing, it is to be in touch with the immigrant community, to bring to their homes the Know Your Rights kit. And, of course, we are advising them in what to do if immigration customs enforcement knock on their door, to make sure that they identify first who is at the door. Instead of just going and quickly open the door, we want to make sure that people see who is out there, if they feel safe, come to the door. But not only they are sure they can open the door. So we were distributing posters that we recommended to put it in the entrance of the door. And that way they know, like if an ICE agent is at the door, they should not open the door. They should ask if they have a warrant to pass it through the door. And also to let them know if they are at the workplace, if they are in church, if they are doing their groceries, what to do if they got stopped by an immigration police or an agent that comes from the Customs Enforcement Office, to say their name and then we are handing cards, wallet cards that have the right, like they have the right to remain silent, just say the name, and then they have the right to call a lawyer.
So how did the canvassing go?
Yeah, I mean, we found people at the end. In our team, we tallied the results. We spoke with 103 people. Once they saw, of course, that we were not ICE, so they opened the door. They were very receptive, and they were very grateful for the information that they were receiving. Even there was a lady that says, oh, I'd like you to meet my pastor, and I'd like you to come to my church and do a Know Your Rights workshop in my church.
Did you find people who said they were afraid?
You can see the fear speaking about this and asking questions about, okay, so, but there is a lawyer that we can trust if something happens. So people are very concerned.
Now, you had the information in Spanish and English, but it was pointed out that there are undocumented immigrants from many countries where people speak other languages.
Yeah, no, in fact, we make the commitment to translate the document. One of our members has connections with the Middle East community to translate it into maybe Arabic. I think that there were conversations to see if we can translate this in Farsi, in Mandarin too. People from China and other places around that speak Chinese or Mandarin that also are in the same situation.
Fatima Rojas, you did this outreach work on Saturday, and then on Sunday, 300 people came to a synagogue in the New Haven area to learn how they could support undocumented immigrants by accompanying them in various ways, like going to immigration court or providing transportation. You were one of the speakers. How did you feel about that event?
I felt great. I feel that it was a great event because even though we are facing a really challenging and very backwards situation here with all these executive orders that the actual president is signing. Also, there is a huge positive vibe among a diverse community that want to do something. People that I asked 1 year ago, can you please help my husband to sign this petition for his place that he's trying to unionize, and say, well, no, I cannot sign anything. I cannot get active in the community in this way. The same people now is saying, how can we help? Can we help? How can we plug in? There is a lot of people that want to do something. They are willing to do surveys. They are willing to do canvassing. They are willing to give rights, as you are mentioning. They are also offering their houses. If there is a family or there is a couple or there are kids that need a place, a safe place to stay, if there is a raid or if they are in any kind of danger, immigration danger per se. So just to see that crystallized in that room with 300 people is a huge positive statement of unity, and it brings a lot of hope to what we are trying to protect our community.
That was Fatima Rojas, a leader of the immigrant advocacy group Unidad Latina en Acción in New Haven, Connecticut. Learn more about immigrant advocacy organizations' response to the Trump administration's ICE crackdown by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
At the axis of language and philosophy, De Saussure examines the field of linguistics by separating two controlling facets therein, speech and language. Speech, he argues, is at every moment an existing institution which is a product of the past, Saussure 8. Language, in which speech has its home, from its very inception created by a collectivity, Saussure 11. That is, it cannot subsist in a solitary soul. It must be shared, or it simply cannot exist, Saussure writes. For language is not complete in any speaker. It must be perfectly only within a collectivity. But what were the elements that gave rise to speech and language? Saussure teaches that the core concept of these communicative institutions is the coherence between the signifier and the signified, or the utilization of signs to project meanings to others. Levi Strauss, an acclaimed anthropologist, suggests the deconstruction of words into base phonemes opens doors to meaning. He writes, quote, "Linguistics teaches us precisely that structured analysis cannot be applied to words directly, but only to words previously broken down into phonemes." Levi Strauss, 36. Dessoiseurs doesn't agree, for he determines that language bits in their written form, words equal signs, called phonemes, are actually arbitrary, having no intrinsic meaning. Saussure, 67, 68. Words mean, it seems, whatever we collectively agree what they mean. But all languages are not created equal, as Fanon illustrated in his classic Black Skin, White Masks. By training, a psychiatrist, Fanon plunges into the psyches of the colonizer and the colonized and shows us how language, especially French, acts to denigrize oppressed communities, assigning ascension in racial states from savage to civilized based on one's facility and mastery of the language of the colonizing power. Africanity, then, is the dark abode of savagery. And in Afro-Caribbean communities, this station is marked by what Fanon calls pidgin nigger dialect, Creole, Fanon, 23. In French and European consciousness, their languages are true languages and models of sophistication. Blacks, however, spoke in dialects. Why? Because, as Fanon observed, to speak a language is to take on a world, Fanon, 25. Obversely, if this is so, so too may the opposing principle be assumed. To lose an ancestral language is to lose a world. Fanon, an astute political actor, knew that it was power that determines place. This may be seen in two historical political examples. Fanon cites, without attribution, the observation, "What matters is not to know the world, but to change it." The Caribbean island of Haiti, which waged a successful revolution against their French enslavers, upon independence adopted Creole as its official language, and while French is used by its elites, Creole is the tongue of the masses. Thus we see that language is more than a phonemetic phenomenon. It is a political vehicle as well, which serves political and economic purposes. Derrida's two articles provide insight into dual dimensions of communication, the written word and the sign. While one has a fixed character, which may experience drift over the passage of time, the other, because it allows multiple readings, is of a more amorphous character. For though it has structure, that structure is not fixed. Derrida's article on structure begins with the essence of philosophy, which, because of its contradictory nature, both seeks structural forms and rejects them in search of new forms. For philosophy, Derrida notes, is congenitally oppositional, Derrida 3. That's because philosophers question old verities and seek to destabilize vaunted philosophical positions and theories. Philosophy, then, is an eruption of new theories colliding with previous ones. That is the nature of questioning, for the mind is never truly at rest. Upon Derrida's observation, philosophy seems a science of eccentricity. For approaches to comparative cultural studies too, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Liberation. From the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, now comes the rise of Law for Black Lives, a collective of lawyers, law students, jailhouse lawyers, and other legal workers.
in support of the latest iteration of the Black Freedom Movement. It couldn't come at a better time. For times of social movements need all the legal assistance it can muster. For those who oppose that system of white supremacy and rampant necrophobia are often targeted by that same system for special punishment. Perhaps the most renowned black lawyer in U.S. history, Charles Hamilton Houston, who trained Thurgood Marshall in the law, taught his students, a lawyer's either a social engineer or he's a parasite on society. Today, of course, he'd say she. Marshall, Houston's star pupil, who later went on to become the nation's first black Supreme Court justice, would recount one of his law professor's most potent lessons. There's no law on our side? Let's make some. I carry these words to L4BL. Let's make some. But I hasten to add this lesson from a jailhouse lawyer. The law is a tool of the state, often used for repression. Where are the lawyers challenging unjust and unconstitutional laws like Clinton's Anti-Terrorist and Effective Death Penalty Act, known as AEDPA, A-E-D-P-A, or the Prison Litigation Reform Act? These so-called laws were designed to enshrine injustice in statute. The gay rights movement forced the fall of DOMA, the patently unconstitutional Defense of Marriage Act. It's time for the Black Freedom Movement to force the fall of AEDPA and PLRA, acts based on lies and injustice, which have contributed to mass incarceration. I've quoted a preeminent law professor. Now, let me quote an outlaw, revolutionary naturalist John Africa of the MOVE organization, a man bombed by the government on May 13, 1985 in Philadelphia. This is what John Africa taught MOVE members. Just because it's legal, don't make it right. Remember, the Holocaust was legal. Slavery, one of the greatest crimes against humanity, was legal. The mass internment of Japanese Americans, according to the U.S. Supreme Court's Korematsu decision, was legal. All of this was legal. But was it right? To L4BL, let's fight for what's right. For freedom, not mass incarceration. For justice, not repression. Because Black Lives Matter, all Black Lives Matter. On the MOVE, long live John Africa. All power to the people. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
The end of the year, for anyone out there who doesn't have a firm grasp of the obvious, and I was looking back through the calendar to see if I could find where my time went. By my sense of things, I'm missing several months. I don't even remember spring. Did we have spring? We did, didn't we? Anyway, looking through the calendar, I saw all of the capitalized holidays, the ones that the federal government recognizes, and I noticed something. You know, just a curious observation. Whenever I have a curious observation, you have to suffer through it. The word holiday is really a mashup of two words, holy and day. Holidays began as holy days, days that are held sacred by practitioners of a common religion. And it struck me that, as Americans, we have our own set of holidays or holy days. And that means that, as Americans, we suffer from a common religion. Did I say suffer? Yeah, I meant that. Just wanted to point that out in case anybody missed it. So where was I? Yeah, Americanism is a kind of secular religion, a particular denomination of nationalism, and this secular religion has its own religious calendar. Let me walk you through it.
We start with New Year's Day on January 1st, a recognized holy day. This day is set aside on our secular religious calendar with a prohibition against work, much like the Sabbath under Judaism. We spend New Year's Day recovering from alcohol poisoning and attempting to recover all of the photocopies and or selfies of our various body parts that were distributed the night before. Next, we have Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. We celebrate this holy day with a work prohibition, so America doesn't feel nearly as racist as it really is. Also, we can't celebrate Malcolm X Day because he said things like chickens come home to roost and other stuff that makes him too radical for a racist nation to ever embrace him. So, by default, we have Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. Imagine if we celebrated Nat Turner Day, white men in suits chased by machete-wielding blacks. Yeah, but I digress. In February, we have President's Day, where we worship the deluded hierarchs who assume the right to rule us, some of whom have their faces dynamited into the side of sacred Native American burial grounds. But there is no corresponding Tecumseh Day, or Crazy Horse Day, or Geronimo Day, and there are no Native American faces dynamited into the grounds of Arlington National Cemetery. Go figure. In May and November, we have Memorial Day and Veterans Day, respectively, two holy days that serve as bookends for our crop cycle. So at planting and harvesting, we worship those who have maintained the colonizers' babies for breakfast program. Flags, hot dogs, prosthetics, yay for us. That takes us to July 4th, where we celebrate American independence. Fireworks, more flags, more hot dogs, bad music. Labor Day comes in the fall, where we pay lip service to the value of toiling under oppression and worshiping everyone who came before us, wasting their lives the way we waste ours. More hot dogs, flags, beer. Next, we have Columbus Day, celebrating the central figure to the vast extermination of the people who lived here before we planted a flag and built a Walmart. Our celebrating of Columbus Day in America is analogous to Germans celebrating Hitler Day if they had won their expansionist war. Those silly Germans. Nobody commits genocide as effectively as Americans. Next, we have Halloween, where we dress up our kids in a throwback to a time when delinquents extorted food from homeowners under the threat of burning down their houses. Now our kids just play sugar-coated Russian roulette with razor blades concealed by sociopathic strangers, or get hopped up on an overdose of high-fructose corn syrup and hallucinate all night long. Which takes us to Thanksgiving, where we overindulge on tryptophan in celebration of some essential American values, like befriending and manipulating others before murdering their kids and stealing their land. Then we sleep through football that's symbolic of encroachment and colonization. Then, the next day, we recreate the original slaughter, only we do it at the mall, and we use credit cards instead of swords. Conquest is so American. Fast forward to Christmas when we celebrate Superman coming to Earth from Krypton in a virgin's womb. I don't know, I might have that mythology confused. Pardon me. On Christmas, we have dry trees covered in electrical lights in our living rooms because baby Jesus is a firebug who likes burning down trailer parks. We place our children in the lap of a strangely dressed bearded stranger in order to condition us for when we hand them over to Uncle Sam, so he can shove them out of a plane over some defenseless third world spot needing a pipeline. And that takes us back to New Year's Eve, where we pathologically drink ourselves into oblivion and photocopy our butts again. So to wrap it all up, America's holy days appear to revolve around the worship of warmongers, hierarchs, and genocidal sociopaths, with a token black guy tossed in for good measure, and a day of lip service to hard work setting you free, even though it won't, and a couple of holidays that are thinly disguised reenactments of child sacrifice. When we consider this secular religion of Americanism by analytically considering its designated holy days, we recognize how profoundly disturbing it really is. Let's do the sensible thing in 2017. Let's scrap it. Hashtag dumpster fire. Now, before you go there, I don't even know what that means. I just figured that would be a nice way to end the segment. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from War and Corruption in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance. I just want to celebrate.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren, CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. President in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
Unique threat did Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam pose to the American establishment in the 1960s? How might the black radical tradition of Malcolm and Martin King inform contemporary racist policies in the era of President Donald Trump? Is it possible to challenge racial injustice without confronting capitalism? What was the significance of the MOVE organization founded by John Africa, and why did authorities seek to bomb the MOVE residents in 1985? How is the system continuing to attack Mumia Abu-Jamal and other U.S. political prisoners? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we feature a retrospective on Black History Month and on some of the great movement pioneers seeking to redress the past and ongoing crimes of the racist corporate state in the face of the Trump presidency. We'll hear from commentator Abayomi Azikiwe. We'll hear from MOVE bombing survivor Ramona Africa. And we'll hear from Suzanne Ross of the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. On this week's program, Revolutionary Struggle from Malcolm to Martin to MOVE to Mumia, a Black History Month special. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 24th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories facing our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available for download at the website globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Known, documented, and amply proven, the West is using organizations including ISIS and Al-Qaeda in its attempts to destroy Syria. We also know that the West used and likely continues to use depleted uranium ordnances throughout its illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq. Depleted uranium ordnances are weapons of mass destruction that continue to kill innocent Iraqis and will do so for many years to come. But the recently disclosed story about the U.S. using depleted uranium ordnances in Syria is suspect, not because there is reasonable doubt that the U.S. used them, but because the story is being conflated in Western media with the notion that the weapons were used against ISIS. While the West sometimes attacks both sides to prolong the destruction and warfare, and or to create intra-Syrian conflict, the notion that the weapons were used against ISIS infrastructure is intentionally misleading in the sense that it creates the false perception that the West is trying to destroy ISIS despite on-the-ground evidence to the contrary. That comes from the article, "The Counterterrorism Campaign in Syria is Fake. Dark State Manipulations Serve as Barriers to Peace," by Mark Taliano, posted February 19th. Liberals and conservatives are now publicly allied in demonizing Putin and Russia and supporting a very dangerous military confrontation initiated by Obama and championed by the defeated Hillary Clinton. In the past, these opposed political factions accepted that they would rotate their titular leaders into and out of the White House, and whenever the need arose to depose one or the other, that business would be left to deep state forces to effect in secret, and everyone would play dumb. Now the game has changed. It's all obvious. The deep state has seemingly gone shallow. That comes from the article, The Deep State Goes Shallow, Reality TV Coup d'Etat in Prime Time, by Edward Curtin, posted February 21st. It was supremely wicked and rapidly meandered into horse-muddied waters. U.S. President Donald J. Trump had openly expressed what many a U.S. politician has felt but avoided for the sake of false decency. The two-state solution regarding Israel and Palestine was, quote, a bad idea, unquote. There was only one supremo in this fight, and it certainly did not entail the downtrodden in Gaza or the West Bank. In his consistently inconsistent manner before a press corps he has come to loathe, Trump also claimed that he could, quote, live with two-state or one-state, unquote. Quote, I'm looking at two-state and one-state, and I like the one both parties like. I'm very happy with the one that both parties like. Unquote. That comes from the article, A Tale of Two Realities, Donald Trump and Israel, by Dr. Binoy Kampmark, posted February 20th. The Western fiat currency regime should be dissolved. Most outstanding debts should be extinguished, debt jubilee, massive write-offs, large-scale revaluations, and national sovereignty must regain prominence across the entire globe. A balanced financial system based principally on equitable assets must take the place of the current debt-based system. Sovereign governments should look to take on the crucial role as their own primary issuer of currency. This, of course, would require much more honest and transparent governance than we currently have in place. A new system of loose, decentralized global governance should be constructed to act as an impartial arbiter in geopolitical and economic affairs. These are but a few of the possible reforms that could be made to affect a more intelligent paradigm of globalism. That comes from the article, Analyzing the Emerging World Order, The Future of Globalism, by Levon Duran, posted February 19th. While socialism as a political ideology and economic system was challenging the hegemony of capitalism and imperialism, there was the emergence of the national liberation movements throughout Africa, Asia, and Latin America, which both the socialist camp and the West were attempting to win over to the respective world outlooks. African Americans objectively had no real material interest in maintaining capitalism and imperialism. The system of exploitation and world conquest had been made possible as a result of the capital accrued from the profits generated from the Atlantic slave trade and the rise of colonialism. Hidden Figures addresses this dilemma by focusing on the role of Jim Crow as a facilitator of racial capitalism and social containment. Nonetheless, it was the African-American people themselves who opened up the challenge to institutional racism in the U.S. That comes from a review of the film Hidden Figures under the headline, The U.S. Space Program and the Cold War, Historic Role of African-American Women, by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted February 22nd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Abayomi Azikiwe is an outspoken political commentator. He's editor of Pan-African Newswire and a frequent contributor to Global Research. He spoke recently at Henry Ford College in Dearborn, Michigan, in honor of African American History Month, where he addressed the subject of the global dimensions of the life and legacy of Malcolm X. He joins us now. Once again, sir, thanks for joining us. It's great to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
Now, we're having this conversation on the occasion that it's been 52 years since the assassination of Malcolm X, and I'm wondering if you could speak to the essential components of Malcolm X's legacy that would speak to the current political crisis.
Yeah, Malcolm X was a political being. His parents were involved in the Garvey movement. The Universal Negro Improvement Association which was formed by Marcus Garvey in 1914 and reached its height in the 1920s. Malcolm was born in 1925. His father was also a preacher. He was a Baptist minister, and his mother had been a organizer and a writer for the Negro World newspaper, which is the newspaper of the UNIA. So, yes, he grew up in a political atmosphere, but at the same time, as a result of the racism, his father was reported was killed by a white paramilitary group in Lansing, Michigan in 1931. And the family, of course, never being able to recover from this loss, was eventually broken up during the 1930s. Malcolm lived in foster homes. He eventually went to live with an older sister in Boston in 1941, right on the eve of the United States intervention in World War II. And during the course of the war, he worked in menial jobs on the railway system, worked as a shoeshine in shoeshine shops. He also got involved in criminal activity, which landed him in prison in 1946 in the aftermath of World War II. Now, during this time period, there were tremendous upheavals that were going on in the world, and you had the whole question of national liberation movements during World War II in places such as Algeria, and also in the aftermath of World War II with the Rand Minor strike in South Africa, the beginning of the independence movement in Ghana in 1948, and so many other struggles that were taking place, the Chinese Revolution of 1949, the Vietnamese and Korean revolutions of 1945. So Malcolm X came out of prison in 1952 in a period in which there was much political ferment that was taking place. He had been converted to Islam under the Nation of Islam, headed by Elijah Muhammad. The organization was founded in Detroit in 1930, and then he became a leader during the 1950s within the Nation of Islam, bringing in nationalist ideas, militancy, and also a national image for the organization, because he was a very articulate and a very well-spoken individual who attracted a lot of new people to the Nation of Islam, particularly young people. So he was very much a part of the whole political landscape of the 1950s and the early 1960s that paralleled not only the national liberation struggles internationally, but also inside the United States, the rise of the civil rights movement and the antecedents of the Black Power movement.
Now, the other wing of the African American liberation movement was the that co-founded by Dr. King with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, in which he seemed to advocate a different approach. And it seemed as if you know, maybe there's a bit of revisionism here, but it seemed like the Martin Luther King vision that he seemed to embody seemed a little bit easier for media at the time to digest, whereas Malcolm X, you know, speaking on about advocating self-reliance and independent statehood and self-defense, it seemed a lot harder to digest. Can you speak to that issue of what made Malcolm X threatening to powerful interests within the U.S.?
Malcolm X talked about a lot of things that many African Americans thought about or discussed in private in terms of the hatred of racism, the hatred of the exploitative system, and why should African Americans attempt to reform or integrate into this system, that a better alternative would be to separate from it, either a migration out of the United States back to Africa or somewhere else in the world, or breaking up the United States and setting aside 8 to 10 states within the continental United States and paying African Americans reparations for several decades until they could achieve self-reliance and independence as a state. And this was a radical departure from what the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was advocating, and even the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in its early days. Now, as the 1960s progressed, there was a coming together of both of these tendencies, King and Malcolm X, as far as I know, only met on one occasion, and that was in Washington, D.C., outside the U.S. Congress, as the Civil Rights Bill was being debated. After Malcolm X left the Nation of Islam in early 1964, he had pledged to work with all the civil rights organizations in some type of united front. He also attempted to authenticate himself as a Orthodox Muslim by going once again to Saudi Arabia. Now, he had been to Saudi Arabia in 1959, but he had gone as an emissary of Elijah Muhammad. He went again in 1964 to partake in the Hajj, the pilgrimage. And he did that for political as well as religious reasons. And at the same time, he traveled extensively to other Middle Eastern states as well as throughout the African continent. He wanted to internationalize the African-American struggle, as had been done in Angola and Mozambique and South Africa and Algeria and Ghana. He wanted to win over African heads of state, liberation movements, to raise the whole question of human rights violations against African Americans within international bodies, particularly the United Nations. And this made him even more of a target on the part of the United States government. And that is revealed, which a lot of this material now is online, through thousands upon thousands of files from the FBI and other government agencies. They kept close tabs on Malcolm. He was under surveillance. It appears on a 24-hour basis, and there was no sympathy or admiration from the state towards Malcolm X, and that's clearly revealed in the FBI documents, as I mentioned before, many of which have been published and are available online now.
Can you speak to like I said, it's been 52 years, and I'm wondering if in the interim since his death, if you've noticed any significant distortions of who he was and what he contributed to the general understanding of the plight of African Americans within the United States?
Yes, there has been, as it has been with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as well. With respect to Malcolm X, they portray him as a figure who promoted hate and intolerance. Sometimes they'll say he, at one point, promoted hate and intolerance and then became an advocate of multiracialism and integration as a result of his travels and acceptance of Orthodox Islam. Both of these characterizations are false, and they do bring about a distorted historical perspective. Also, there's a tendency to downplay or either ignore the legacy of Malcolm X. And Martin Luther King's legacy, of course, is distorted as well because they only talk about certain phases of his work. They very rarely mention, if ever, his opposition to the war in Vietnam. His seeing the war in Vietnam as a symptom of a much deeper malady within American society, characterizing U.S. foreign policy as being imperialist. Also, he called the last 2 years of his life for guaranteed annual income for everyone, full employment for everyone inside the United States, vacation inside. Actually, fighting for labor union recognition for a group of African-American sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee, in the South. So if Malcolm X had not been assassinated, it would, in all likelihood, they would have formed some type of an alliance. Dr. Martin Luther King, of course, was assassinated just like Malcolm X was. And I think the release of this documentary film on James Baldwin that came out earlier this month, where they take the text of an unfinished manuscript that Baldwin was working on at the time of his death in the late 1980s, and utilize that to look at the lives of Megger Evers, who was another pioneering civil rights activist in Mississippi. He was a field secretary for the NAACP. Baldwin was also looking at Malcolm X, as well as Martin Luther King. He knew all of these figures, had good relationships with all of them, and I think all of these three figures, although they had different fields of work and worked in different geographical areas of the country, had many similarities, as opposed to many scholars and analysts focus on their differences. But all of them fell victim to the racist state repression inside the United States.
And you just talked about Dr. King and the evolution in his thinking, that famous speech that he gave at Riverside Church nearly half a century ago, in which he referred to the evil triplets of not only racism, but materialism and militarism. So I'm curious to probe your own thoughts about if it's possible to substantively confront any one of those evils without confronting the others. Can you, for example, eliminate racial discrimination within a capitalist system, even a reformed, kinder, gentler, say, social democratic system?
No, I don't think you can. I think the issue of U.S. foreign policy is clearly linked with this domestic policy. All we have to do is examine the countries that have been attacked over the last quarter century, since the first Gulf War. Those countries have been in the Middle East. They have been in Africa. They have been in Latin America. They have been in the Asia Pacific and Central Asia. This is very, very important for people to recognize. The former Yugoslav Federation was bombed extensively in 1999 to break up the last bastion of a socialist economic and political system in Europe. And this, too, had its own geopolitical significance from the standpoint that now almost all of these states are part of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. All of the former socialist states in Eastern Europe, and they still are being utilized as a bulwark against the now Russian Federation, which is also a source of tremendous tension in the world and also a source of attack against the presidency of Donald Trump. I personally do not believe that the Trump administration is any less hostile towards Russia than the previous administration of Barack Obama. If you look at the appointees that surround Trump, the policy analysts that advise him, most of them during the confirmation hearings expressed extreme hostility towards Russia, China, Iran, and any other state or non-state entity that is in opposition to U.S. imperialist foreign policy. So I don't think you can separate U.S. foreign policy from domestic policy, which is still rooted in institutional racism. Inside the United States now, African Americans are still subjected to national discriminatory practices. They still have substantially higher unemployment rates than whites do. They're still subjected to police violence, higher incarceration rates, unfavorable rulings by the courts. And this, of course, has its own economic character as well. The country was largely built on the backs of the forced removal of the indigenous people and the enslavement and exploitation of the African people. All of these three evils that Dr. King talked about at his Riverside Church speech on April 4th of 1967, and in subsequent addresses, a lot of which are coming out now and being listened to again, having been suppressed for decades, reveal his evolving ideological, political outlook. And that's why he became such a threat, not only to the FBI, but also to the Johnson administration, which had broken communications completely with Dr. King during the last year of his life.
We're currently facing major challenges with these freedom struggles, not only with the ongoing police state mechanisms by Donald Trump and his forerunners, but you also have that threat of co-option and pacification by the Democratic Party, by black representative organizations. And I'm wondering if you see anything on the horizon that suggests that real, meaningful change is not only possible but inevitable, or if those forces of co-option and pacification will prevail.
I think there is a possibility of building independent political organizations and movements. The Democratic Party is trying to get out in front of the mass dissent and opposition to the Trump administration. But in reality, they are not leading these demonstrations. Now, the right wing is trying to say that these demonstrations are being led by disgruntled Democrats. That is not the case at all. And the corporate media has a role in that, in fostering that viewpoint, because they, in most of the time, only interview people who are either officials or representatives of the Democratic Party or have that type of political orientation. So they realize that both parties are in crisis right now in the United States. I mean, the fact that Donald Trump was able to essentially walk in off the street, having held no political office prior to becoming president, and not only gained the nomination easily, for the Republican Party, but also secure victory over Hillary Clinton, who was a veteran politician. She, of course, was not appealing to large numbers of people, even within her own constituency. A lot of people who did not vote, a lot of people who switched and voted for Trump because they did not want what Hillary Clinton represented, and were dissatisfied with the 8 years of the Barack Obama administration, which came in with a lot of hope, and a lot of people had the hope that Obama was going to make some fundamental changes. That did not happen, and that served to fuel the Trump campaign. He won the Electoral College by a comfortable margin. The problem he has, though, is that he was almost 3 million votes short in terms of electoral majority in the United States. You can also count the people who did not vote at all, which was a substantial portion of the electorate, perhaps half or if not more than half. And his policies have tended to alienate large sectors of the U.S. Population. So he has a serious problem. And if he's offending the corporate media and elements within the intelligence community, he's really in a very precarious situation in terms of maintaining any type of stable administration. Even people in the Republican Party, for example, John McCain, when he went to the Munich Security Conference earlier this month, characterized the Trump administration as being in disarray. This is almost unprecedented to have this type of split within the Republican Party itself. So I think Trump is a reflection of the instability of the American political system. And I think in the next few years, we're going to see a breaking up of both the Republican and the Democratic parties and a new political landscape that will come into being.
Abiyomi Azikiwe, I want to thank you very much for these valuable reflections. It's always great to have you on the show.
Okay, thank you for inviting me.
We've been speaking with Abayomi Azikiwe, editor of Pan-African Newswire, political commentator, and frequent contributor to Global Research. You can find his articles at the site panafricannews.blogspot.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. The Move 9 were profiled in an interview from January 2016. They were 9 members of the Move family, a group adhering to the principles of protecting life, founded by John Africa. In 1978, they were rounded up in a police raid on their house in Powelton Village, found guilty for the death of police officer James Ramp, and sentenced to 30 to 100 years behind bars. The incarceration of these individuals and the bombing attack on their home 7 years later has been seen by MOVE supporters as an attack on a movement challenging a violent and unjust system rather than consistent with the principles of law and order. Ramona Africa is the only adult survivor of the MOVE bombing of 1985. The Global Research News Hour caught up with Ramona during our July 2016 coverage of the Democratic National Convention to get her thoughts about MOVE, systemic violence, and the role of conventional politicians in instigating change. Could I ask you maybe a personal question? You've spoken about the influence that John Africa and his messages had on you. Could I maybe get a bit of a portrait from before you encountered him and how you made that transition?
Oh, yeah. I was raised by my mother, never knew my father. He left her before I was even born. So I was raised by my mother, and I have quite a few, or had quite a few aunts and uncles. And I was raised in a middle-class black family, went to Catholic school for 12 years, first to 12th grade. Worked for about 6 months after I graduated from high school, and didn't like too much, you know, the work I was doing. It was a so-called good job at the Philadelphia Electric Company, benefits and everything, but I just couldn't see myself there 25 years later, you know. So I left and went to Temple University. My plan was to become a lawyer, and I graduated from Temple, was going to go to law school that fall, but I met MOVE in the spring of 79, like in March. And I just, once I met MOVE, first MOVE supporters before I even met MOVE members, and was encouraged to go over to City Hall and sit in on some of the MOVE trials, since I wanted to be a lawyer, you know, see firsthand what goes on in these trials. And my mother was in one ear telling me, you can be whatever you want to be a doctor, be a lawyer, you can be the first black woman Supreme Court justice. I mean, I was heavily entrenched in this system, and no getting around that. I was planning to do just that, be a lawyer, then maybe a judge, and maybe a Supreme Court justice. After I met MOVE and started sitting in on those trials, I was aghast. I was in shock, because nothing that these Temple University, where I went, that's my alma mater, it's where I graduated from, none of the professors here at Temple University told me the truth about what happens in those courtrooms. None of the textbooks that I was made to read told the truth about what was happening in those courtrooms. So when I really saw it and really start talking to MOVE people and seeing the truth, that was it. I did not go to law school, although I'm fully equipped, thanks to John Africa, to represent myself in court, which I did, you know. But I did not go to the systems law school. And really, system officials like this judge, Lynn Abraham, really kicked me right on into MOVE because she sent me to prison for contempt for 60 days. And MOVE women were in the county jail. And I spent 2 months, 60 days, up close and personal with MOVE women. There was no turning back after that. When I walked out of that prison after those 60 days, that was it. That was it. So that's how I ended up in MOVE. That was the portrait of my life before MOVE.
And have you continued to grow over the course of that that period now, more than half your life?
Absolutely. One thing that people don't realize is that while MOVE's belief is in life and we work diligently on behalf of life, the real revolution is here. This system have trained and tricked people so badly that we don't realize how deep the system goes in us. And the real work, the most important work, which we will never stop doing while we're alive on this level of life, is working it off of us. That work never ends. I mean, you know, we will never get all of this system out of us while we're on this level. It's just ongoing work. We'll get better. We'll get stronger. We'll get clearer about the importance of life and more uncompromising with that. But the system is deeply entrenched in us. We don't realize how much we take for granted as right, acceptable, okay. That isn't. That the system trained us.
I think I hear what you're saying because I mean, I think I've used the term colonialism when it comes to these sorts of issues. I mean, there's a much more, a very pronounced problem within Canada with regard to the way the native peoples are dealt with by police and by the wider society, and the sense that just we may even think like here in Temple University or the university where I'm situated, people may learn things and know them in an intellectual way, but then instinctively they continue to behave as if they're colonized, as if they're controlled, and at this racist level.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I am the least likely suspect to be a MOVE member, a revolutionary. My mother was a beautician by trade. She, quote unquote, did my hair from the time I was a little girl. Just the hair alone should have turned me off, but it didn't. It didn't. I had never had any run-ins or brutal run-ins with cops growing up. I read about them. You know, I knew about the Panthers. I knew who Angela Davis was. I knew who Fred Williams was, you know. I like you said, I knew about this intellectually, but I'm the least likely suspect to have become a MOVE member. And like I said earlier, for real, it's this system. It's supporters and people that believe in it. That really pushed me right on into MOVE. Pushed me right on into MOVE.
So you have to. Do you have to live in a community in order to stay true to those ideals?
I would say yes, because we don't really have the strength and the wherewithal to just do this on our own. I mean, we would try to remain true. There are people that have left MOVE. You know, not really most of them because they had a problem with MOVE, but it was the intimidation and brutality coming from the cops, the threat of jail, you know. They just couldn't handle it. But they left, and in their minds, they were going to, you know, keep doing the things that, you know, they did in move, even health-wise, running, exercising, or eating a certain way and all that. And they just couldn't do it on their own. That's why family is so important. Family is the backbone of MOVE, you know, looking out for each other, encouraging each other, correcting each other when we stray from what's right, you know.
If you could clarify a detail about the authorities, quote unquote, saw MOVE as a threat. Was it the sense of love? Was it the sense of family? Was it sheer vindictiveness?
It was the wisdom of John Africa, because the information that John Africa amassed in this system, I mean, just really exposing this system's vindictiveness and hatred of life, really, of life. They couldn't tolerate that. They couldn't have that. Because when we put out information given us by John Africa, there was nothing those who run this system could do to deny it and you know, dispute it. They couldn't do it. I'm going to have to go.
I wanted to ask one more question. We're in the lead up to this Democratic National Convention, and I was wondering what you've noticed or seen on the ground in the lead up in terms of the way the police are behaving, the politicians. Is there any sense of impending something?
They know that people are getting sick and tired and frustrated with the status quo, you know. Certainly the police killings, you know, but really across the board. People are, I mean, they've been working for $15 an hour, you know, jobs, been pushing for that for a while. Now, people can't live on minimum wage, and people are just frustrated. They're really not trying to hear any nonsense, and they don't really see any solution in either candidate. And to me, that's a good thing, because it's past time people stop looking to a politician or anybody else to make things right for them, because it's not going to happen. The work, the commitment has to come from the people. And I think folks are being pushed to that point now. And I see that as a good thing.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is one of America's most high-profile political prisoners. Originally placed on death row for the shooting death of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner, his case has been reviewed. He is now serving a life sentence, but the campaign to free Mumia lives on. Mumia has been facing threats to his life as he is ailing from untreated hepatitis C, which the state correctional institution in which he is located has been denying him that treatment. His situation has been complicated by poor water quality in the prison. Suzanne Ross is a clinical psychologist, a longtime anti-imperialist activist, and a representative of International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. She spoke to us a year ago about Mumia's situation and joins us again right now for an update. Suzanne, thanks so much for speaking with us again.
Good morning, Michael. It's good to be on again. Always like to get the word out on our brother.
The last time we spoke, you talked about the situation with the hepatitis C that he was ailing from, and that you were before the courts trying to help get Mumia the treatment that he so desperately needs. And I was wondering if you could maybe speak to any updates on the legal front.
Yes, I definitely can. And it's important to note from the get-go and to kind of make people aware that this case, as wonderful as Mumia is and as amazing a revolutionary as he is, a writer, a journalist, everything that he is, everything that's about his case affects thousands of other people. And he has been in that role historically almost from the start. His presence on death row originally, where he was placed in 1982, and his book, Live from Death Row, brought the humanity of the people who are on death row to millions of people around the world. That book was translated into I don't know how many languages. I know Fidel Castro, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and many, many people, students and young activists in particular, all over the world, learned about not only his case, but what death row meant and how horrible it was that thousands of people were placed in death row and, you know, with just a sense that they were barbarians and horrible people who deserved to die instantly. And Mumia really exposed how many of them were innocent to begin with, and secondly, how many of them were wonderful people who had made a mistake or had done something in their youth that they had overcome but could never get away from the death penalty. So we're in the same situation now where Mumia, who got sick about 2 years ago, he had contracted hepatitis C when he was shot in the original incident for which he was held guilty, but he was shot by the cops and beaten up on the way to the prison, on the way to the hospital, and was in very, very bad shape and needed emergency transfusions, and that's how he got contracted hepatitis C, through those transfusions. But the prison never did anything about it, never even let him know he had hepatitis C, until he was transferred off death row in 2011, and he found out he has this illness. But he wasn't very sick at that time, and so he kind of let it go. He asked about it. They offered no treatment. And around 2 years ago, he got very, very sick, and some of your listeners probably saw that horrific picture of him when he was so ill, where the picture of death was all over that picture, all over him, and everyone who saw it thought, oh, my God, this brother's dying. And he really did almost die, and had it not been for the movement, which intervened actively and immediately and nonstop, he would not be alive today. There's no question that he was on his road to death. He did, you know, under the pressure of the movement, he did get some kind of attention. He was taken to hospital. He was given emergency diagnosis, and so they began to see, first of all, that they had given him steroids to deal. He had originally had this skin disease that they couldn't diagnose, which turned out to be a symptom of hepatitis C. Not that the prison discovered that, but outside doctors diagnosed that. And they were treating him for this skin disease with steroids, which caused the diabetes, and he was close to diabetic shock and was very, very ill. So they made some adjustments. But Mumia's lawyers went to court. Now it's about over a year ago, more like a year and a half ago, demanding immediate treatment and demanding this cure that is available. There is a cure out there that's very expensive in the United States, but quite inexpensive in several other countries, and could be made inexpensive if the corporation, if the pharmaceuticals weren't so greedy. At any rate, the lawyers and the movement began demanding that he get this treatment, and the Department of Corrections first claimed he didn't have hepatitis C, then they said they couldn't give him this medication, and so there was finally a court hearing, which was unusual that they would grant a court hearing, an in-person court hearing. Mumia was not in courtroom except by television, and so we could see him, and he testified, and we testified as well. The lawyers testified, and two of us, including myself, testified on his behalf as friends, and the courtroom was packed, and they had to get an overflow room to get to accommodate all the people. Remember, this is not in Philadelphia or New York. This is in, I'm trying to remember the name of the town. It's halfway between New York and Harrisburg, the capital. But anyway, he's in this courtroom and with supporters and a spirit that's very, very inspiring. And you could see the judge is impressed and is impressed by Mumia, who testifies so impressively, and by Mumia's doctor, who was very impressive, describing how sick he was. And this is Mumia's doctor again, who was brought in by us, not his official doctor in the prison. And the prison people were outrageous, denying serious illness, saying they were treating him. One of them, one of the lawyers, actually perjured herself. She changed the testimony of a doctor. She actually changed the text. And the doctor sounded, forgive the, this is not a hyperbole, this is really not. The doctors resembled Nazi doctors in their lack of compassion, their willingness to have thousands of people die from an illness which they weren't treating. Well, lo and behold, about a year later, this past January, January 3rd of this year, 1 year later, we're thinking the judge is not responding. People knew the judge was sympathetic, but, you know, often liberal judges cave in under political pressure. He issued a ruling saying that Mumia is entitled to this medicine and that the Department of Corrections is obligated to give it to him immediately, within 21 days, and that to deny him this treatment when he's as ill as he is tantamount to a violation of the Eighth Amendment, the violation that protects all of us against cruel and unusual punishment. That, in fact, denying him that medication is a form of cruel and unusual punishment. We were shocked. I mean, some of us were really shocked because it was such a strong statement in support of what we were all saying and so clear about the outrage of their denying him this treatment. And, of course, everyone else who's not getting it, which is 6,000 to 7,000 other prisoners in Pennsylvania alone. Well, in the process, we found that this hepatitis C is spread all over the prisons in the United States and in many communities, that the lack of treatment is, in fact, this huge scandal, an epidemic, an illness of epidemic proportion right now in this country that is being ignored, and because of the greed of the pharmaceutical companies, it costs them $62 to produce the full medication. You know, the medication involves a pill a day for 3 months. It costs the company $62 to produce this pill. On the market, it costs approximately $94,000. I'm going to repeat it, $94,000. 3 month treatment being the pill is $1,000 a pill. And that's how much it costs if you go on the market and try to buy it. Of course, if you have insurance or if you have some other channel, forgetting it can be much cheaper. So this is what the reality of the situation is. And when the judge ordered this within 21 days, the 21 days, of course, are now up and have been up since January 24th. And yet on the last day, like the 20th or the 21st day, the lawyers filed an appeal. They wanted the judge to review his decision and change his decision, and now they filed it to the Third Circuit as well. They're trying to appeal this and prevent Mumia from getting this medication. So this is now turning out to be a huge issue, as I said, not only for Mumia, who is very sick. I mean, he's not as sick as he was 2 years ago. He's much better. But he still has this hepatitis C, this constant itching. He's taking a horrible medication to reduce the itching that's quite toxic, but he can't live without it. He said he can't think straight, he can't do anything if he doesn't have at least several hours a day where he's not itching. This, the form of the skin disease was this horrible, nonstop itching. On top of that, the prison, it turned out the water at Mahanoy Prison, where Mumia is, a few months ago, the problem started where it would be brown, smelly, and even black. And Mumia, one of the things the prison, the DOC, Department of Corrections, is doing to cover their you-know-what is they say they give him treatment, even though they're not giving him the only medicine that can cure it. They say they give him treatment. He's supposed to take these three therapeutic baths a week. Well, he goes to the bathroom, you know, to the bath to go get in the bath, and he looks at this dark, filthy water, and he says, I'm not getting into that. And one of the guards originally said, and I quote the guard, you'd have to be retarded to agree to take a bath in that water. And so that's happened again and again. And there is no clean drinking water either, and there is no clean water that can be even purchased for those who might be able to afford it from their commissary. In the visiting room at Mahanoy, and I know this from my direct experience, I thought I was buying water, and the only thing is this horrible tasting flavored water that has all kinds of chemicals in it. And you can't buy plain water. And in the commissary, you can't buy plain water. So you really are at the mercy of the prison. All of this is now part of the struggle. And, of course, water, the slogan has become water is life. And, it's, you know, from Standing Rock to Flint to the prisons. And this is an issue for our society as a whole, which especially under the Trump administration, things can only be expected to be worse if we don't really watch out and fight what is happening around the pollution of this incredible source of life and necessity for life, water. So we are involved in several campaigns. We've been at the Department of Corrections several times. We've been at the governor's office. We've demonstrated at the prison, in front of the prison to let other families, those, you know, Mumia's family, of course, knows all this, but a lot of times the brothers inside or the sisters inside don't want their families to worry about them and don't tell them. So one day, about a few months ago, we were outside Mahanoy on a Sunday stopping visitors and telling them what's happening. They said, most of them, in fact, all of them had said they had not heard anything about this. Well, we knew this was going on. And when we spoke to the brothers inside, they certainly knew, but the families didn't know. We need families, community, and everybody to know about this. Mm-hmm. So we have several. We've had phone call campaigns, and we've had, now we're waiting on the legal front. We're waiting for what either the judge or the Third Circuit will do about this appeal. The appeals by the Department of Corrections have been filed, and counter filings have been made by our attorneys demanding immediate treatment and saying this is outrageous, that Mumia has still not gotten it way after the deadline that was set by the judge. And appeals, of course, can delay a whole process, but there's no reason that they have to. You can keep on appealing. In the meantime, follow the order of the judge and, you know, decide that it's not going to be spread to other prisoners or whatever. But they have other options. They don't have to deny, be this 100% denial of treatment, which is what they're engaging in.
What can be done when you're talking about something as simple as an appeal,
right,
that's,
well,
able to enable this kind of genocidal set of conditions?
Right. I think that's – we talked about that, as a matter of fact, on – we just had a meeting this past weekend in Philadelphia, and we talked about it as a genocidal strategy. If you're denying water to people, I mean, people get sick. Brian Arroyo said that when he tries drinking this water, if he drinks more than a little sip, he has to immediately go to the bathroom. Other people have developed dysentery-like symptoms. People can't live without water. I mean, they buy juice. They try to buy, you know, a lot of them drink soda, of course, which is terrible for them. You know, that's the situation. I'm thinking, we've been thinking of maybe taking to some international arena and filing this as a human rights issue. We've had some luck with that before. I mean, in terms of publicity, not that anything has happened, but in terms of getting the word out, we have had some success in getting the word out by claiming and demand, you know, claiming correctly that outrageous things are going on in Mumia's case, but this is thousands of others.
Suzanne Ross, it's been delightful to hear from you again. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for calling.
That was Suzanne Ross, spokesperson with the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. For more information on Mumia, the March 1st Water is Life Day of Action, and how to help, please visit the website www.freemumia.com. You've been listening to a special Black History Month edition of the Global Research News Hour. Our show is podcast on the website globalresearch.ca and airs on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show also airs on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Bye for now.